They start making out. Yeah, why don't you take the top off and make out again?
Oh.
And they just push him like step by step by step.
Take him right through it.
And he always asks them how old they are. And when they go, 18, you hear the production crew go, whoa! And the guy goes, 18.
Yeah.
The younger the age is, the more creepy the guy sounds.
Sounds like us.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
I hear you.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Rift.
That's good.
101.1
WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment. This is 101 WRIF, broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. Thanks for listening.
Now
is the Riff's Rippin' Rock at 9 o'clock. 1 solid hour of your Riff Rock and Roll request.
All the excitement and fun you can bear.
With Meltdown, the big unit on the Riff.
Your opportunity to take control of the WRIF playlist.
With the guy who lost control a long time ago.
Call in your Riff Rock and Roll requests to Meltdown at 313-298-WRIF or email them to meltdown@wrif.com.
The Rippin' Rock at 9 o'clock with Meltdown. What a 101. WRIF.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Kickers All-American Grill on Plymouth Road in Livonia. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's 5 best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com. You're listening to 101 WRIF Detroit, a greater media station broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. There's more Riff Rock coming right up, so don't go anywhere.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked about Pittsburgh Steeler Joey Porter, who is fine. But he was shot in the buttocks.
That's how my dad says it. He goes, buttocks. He's always like, you hear about that guy who was shot?
Yeah, where was that?
He was shot in the buttocks.
Where, in the arm?
No, hell no, Mike. He was shot in the buttocks.
I feel like a third grader. This story made me laugh every time I heard it. Guy being shot in the buttocks.
I know. Buttocks.
Like taking a dump and there'd be a hole in it.
Yeah.
Someone yesterday was reporting a story and said he was shot in the hip, and I'm literally yelling at the TV going, no, he was shot in the buttocks.
Somebody is so hung up that they can't find themselves saying buttocks. They have to say hip. People are like bitten by a snake in the ass. Seems like they're always embarrassed because they know it's their buttocks. There's no issue of pain or infection or trauma. It's always just like, yeah, well, it was my damn buttocks.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
I hear you.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101.1 WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
Riff rocks the West Side Tuesday night.
It's a special thing, and kind of like the more pumped I get, the more I crank up the level of it all. We call it the gain or something. It still is too loud, so I gotta calm down. I gotta kind of breathe. I'm just glad to be here. Glad to be able to do this show. Glad you're listening. Glad you're going to participate at 313-298-WRIF or at night call. at WRIF.com. That's nightcall@WRIF.com. And I hope we're streaming live. If you're anywhere in the rest of the country outside of our listening area of Detroit, Ontario, Northern Ohio, and what have you, give us a shout at nightcall@WRIF.com and say you're on board. In fact, you can call in. Sorry, we don't have an 800 number for you, but 313-298-WRIF. If you're, in fact, if you're calling, no, you know what? No, this is not going to work. I was going to say, if you're calling from another city, you know, like far away, we'd take you first. But you know, people are, they'd be calling like from Allen Park or, you know, Grosse Pointe or something like that, and they'd say, yeah, I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. Get me on right away. Wouldn't you? So we can't do that. Anyways, if you're listening and you're far away, give us a shout one way or the other. Let us know. Now, this question about whether we're focusing solely on this show about the war in Iraq and the state of the economy has developed into this email debate. Because a number of people, you know, not a large number, in fact, more accurately, probably a few, have written me and said, all you ever do is talk about Iraq and the economy. There's lots of other things. So, as I always say, these lines are open. In fact, people usually wait a little bit to see what I'm going to introduce. But that's kind of a mistake in a way if you want to talk about something else, because I just might start talking about Iraq and the economy again. So if you want to talk about something different, 313-298-WRIF. You know, and like I said, I don't know really what you want to talk about. You can say, well, that's your job, man. Okay, what's, did you ever get a tattoo you're embarrassed about? You know, I mean, I don't want to talk about that. Yeah, I mean, this is a rock and roll station. We get a couple hours a week to do this, and it's not really an important issue. This, in fact, is a public affairs program. There are some kind of empty talk stations, and I mean, you know, it's okay. I mean, that sounds kind of contemptuous. What I mean by that is, remember I always say the only thing television is good for is mindless entertainment? And in terms of information, turning on television, to me, it's worthless. I never watch television for any news or any commentary or anything like that. And I know once in a while I miss a few things. In the main, it's a waste of my time. If I thought there was good information on television, I'd watch it a lot. As far as I'm concerned, there's next to zero. So I want to read. I want to look at the internet. That's where I get most of my information from. Ideas from reading. Ideas from reading. Reading, you know, books. Remember those things they used to have? They had these little squigglies that represented words and concepts, right? And those are the things that we used to depend upon for all our information and ideas. So usually I'm reading a book or a magazine or a newspaper to get ideas, sometimes information, and often, you know, the immediate stuff am I saying this right? Printed word for ideas, some information, the internet for immediate information, what have you. Now, one of the guys, I think it was Keith, I hope I'm assigning this right, and I should have printed this out, but Keith said, actually, you're right, you're really getting boring just talking about Iraq and the economy. And he said about Iraq, and I mean, maybe he was being funny, because he said it's really overkill. It's really overkill. And he was talking about us continuing to talk about this and increasingly, you know, understood to be this illegal and completely unnecessary war that's taken the lives of thousands and thousands of people. Turns out the first week or so of the war against Iraq, about 15,000 Iraqis were killed. We know now that's up to 400 almost Americans have been killed. Here's a website that I would highly recommend. A lot of you have heard me mentioned this before, buzzflash.com, buzzflash.com. Here's their headline for, it's from yesterday. Insurgents, this is Iraqis, insurgents killed two U.S. paratroopers west of Baghdad, 392 U.S. soldiers dead, 2,230 wounded, 185 GIs dead since Bush taunted the enemy, bring them on. Remember that? Draft-dodging AWOL deserter Bush. Go to awolbush.com if you don't believe me. He said, bring him on. This guy, because of his rich daddy, was able to avoid serving in Vietnam, says, bring him on. Well, not to him. Not to this pampered rich kid that failed at everything he ever did, and Daddy bailed him out all the time. He meant bring him on to our neighbors, our friends, our sons and daughters. Because nobody in his ultra-rich class ever gets in any military clash. Because you know, all those Republicans are a bunch of chicken hawks. They're hawks because they love war, but they made sure that they never served in one when they had the opportunity. Now, 251 dead since Bush did his mission accomplished public relations stunt. Remember that vile stunt that he pulled above, on the USS Abraham Lincoln? And BuzzFlash.com says, and I would echo this, save our soldiers, impeach Bush and Cheney. They violated the Constitution. They violated the oath of office. They are in office illegally. They stole the 2000 election. All right. That's the war. Now, there just was signed, after being passed by the Republican-dominated Congress and signed by George W. Bush, something called the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. It says that it was a political triumph for the anti-abortion movement. I mean, I don't know why they think so. Actually, it was a triumph for men who want to control women's bodies. And they had this signing. You know, sometimes they have the people that were responsible for it. So here you had all these white guys in suits. They all wear power suits. Actually, my wife said one time, I said, how come you don't ever read any of these details? She said, hey, anybody's wearing a suit, they're usually lying. I thought, well, is that fair? Is that fair? Maybe you could even comment on that. I mean, here is a shorthand way to figure out whether someone isn't telling you the truth. They're wearing a suit. I'm trying to think of suit and tie. I don't even own a tie, I say proudly. You know, what's that? Someone who knows a little about medicine, there's this either artery or vein or something on the side of your neck. You know, whenever you start to feel lightheaded, they say, losing his tie. What does that mean for people that are wearing ties all the time? I mean, maybe it does something to your brain, because people can function normally. Look at that pathetic fraud, the pill-popping addict, spokesperson for the conservative movement, Rush Limbaugh. I mean, this guy is a total stoner. And he's out there spewing, you know, all sorts of toxic hatred about the country we live in. Not saying it about the country, but creating a toxicity in the country that we live in. Anyway, so Bush signs this Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. There's this photo op. It's him and all these guys wearing blue suits and red ties. And so these are the guys that are deciding the reproductive rights of women. Huh. And it's not even going to fly. I mean, it's all kind of like a stunt. Almost everything in that Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act has been declared unconstitutional by court after court after court. And it's probably never going to go into effect because it shouldn't. This is about a woman's right to choose, not about a bunch of rich politicians deciding what options a woman can choose. And it's amazing how deep it goes. You are not going to believe this little item. The Browning Construction Company of San Antonio backed out of a project to build a clinic that would provide abortions in Austin, Texas. Very liberal town, by the way. Six weeks after concrete suppliers began a boycott of the job. The chairman, this is the name of an organization. The chairman of the Austin Area Pro-Life Concrete Contractors and Suppliers Association said every concrete supplier within 60 miles of Austin had agreed not to supply materials. This was for a Planned Parenthood clinic in the Texas Capitol, which does a myriad of different aspects of women's health, including providing abortions. That's usually a very small part of any Planned Parenthood clinic. So these men, the Austin Area Pro-Life Concrete Contractors and Suppliers Association, are refusing even to provide the cement that would allow this building to be built. That's the kind of stranglehold these people that would deny women their right to choose the lengths to which they're willing to go to. All right, a couple little short things. All right? So we'd mention Iraq. Won't even go into the economy a little later. Jessica Lynch criticizes these phony baloney Pentagon accounts of her ordeal. But we can talk about it. We can talk about the economy, too. There's an article in the New York Times today called Spammers Can Run, But They Can't Hide. And it's about a man named Steve Linford, who is in lives on Tags Island, England. And what he does, he tracks down spammers. Actually, it turns out that I didn't bring that part of it. The chief spammer, you know, the heaviest spammer in the entire world lives here in Michigan. But, you know, I was thinking about something. If you're on the Internet, if you're not, you know what spam means. You get all this unwanted solicitation, you know, grow your thing 3 inches or septic tanks or me and my dog or, you know, I mean, all this endless stuff. But, you know, I got an email like at Yahoo, which is one of the servers, and it's free. So, I mean, why aren't people complaining, for instance, that there are ads on television? I mean, is there anybody that wants to have a drama or a football game? Lions won 2 in a row. Amazing. You know, interrupted by commercials? Of course not. It's funny that, you know, that advertisers, you know, they know that people really don't like advertisements, but when they hear it, it goes into your brain. Like we're playing, you know, ads on WRIF, and people would rather be hearing rock and roll, but these things stick in our brain. Because we need often, many of the things that are being advertised, the services, the products, and what have you. So you'd rather be hearing Stain, but you're hearing an ad for a car. Well, you're not going to run out and get a car, but the next time you're going to, need a car, you think, oh, yeah, I remember that. That was what he called Ford. I don't want to give any free ads. But so why are people complaining that we get spam on email? I don't like it. But I don't complain about it. All right, one other little trivial thing. They're putting out a new nickel. You know, they put out this new $20 bill, this kind of goofy new $20 bill, and they did it to prevent counterfeiting. It's only been out like a couple of weeks, and they've already arrested 9 separate counterfeiting rings. So I wonder, this money. In a way, all money's fake if you think about it. It's just, what is... You know, it represents value. I mean, it's a piece of paper. I mean, we all kind of go, oh, yes, that is what it is. It represents wealth. What's wealth? I mean, you know, it's pretty complicated, deep stuff. But anyway, you know, it works. Every once in a while it doesn't work, but it's worked here for quite a long time. Anyways, the United States Mint is introducing 2 new designs for the nickel. I don't know why the hell we even have some of these coins. We've always said we should get rid of the penny. All right, get rid of the. Anybody think of any reason we should not get rid of the penny? People say, "Oh, well, then they'll always charge the higher amount." Well, it's, you know, something's. It's only $99.99. The problem is that it creates so many errors in addition. Because if we got rid of the penny, everything would be in fives and zeros. It'd be 5, 10, 15, 20. You know, you'd skip over the zeros. It would work a lot better. So, but then I'm thinking, why do we even need all these coins? Get rid of the nickel. Get rid of the dime. I don't have that much money. If I see a nickel or a dime on the ground, I'm not going to pick it up. I mean, it's not worth that much. I pick up a quarter. Maybe we can pick up a quarter. Figure somebody else could pick up, maybe a kid or something like that. But anyways, so that's I say get rid of all that small change. Rick Fox, Rick Fox is our producer for Night Call tonight. He's also our phone screener, so you'll talk to him when you call 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. This is Night Call and tons of more subjects. I got too many stories tonight. I think I'm going to probably read most of them, but please join us. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Oh, hi, Peter.
Hi.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice again.
Well, thank you. Who's this?
This is your old friend, Billy.
Billy, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Santa Cruz, California.
Really? You're not one of these people that are just trying to get on sooner by saying you're from some place far away?
I've been known to lie a lot about a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it could be.
Right. Prove you're from Santa Cruz.
Okay, let's see. We have the Governor Gropinator.
The Gropinator, yeah.
Yeah.
Win one for the Groper, and they did.
Yeah.
He's hired.
We just had an interesting thing happen on talk radio with that whole story. I don't know if you guys picked it up.
Tell us.
A local guy out here who's just won a Marconi Award, a guy named Ron Owens, who's on, was on with our attorney general. And the attorney general, when asked about the general sort of Grobinator thing, goes into this story about how somebody came up to him just recently and said, my daughter-in-law was, had a problem with this guy in the last 2 years. And he said, well, what if that happened? I would have to do something about it. And it got picked up, and it's just getting all kinds of discussion. Like, you know, why is it that the head Democrat is telling what, and get what Schwarzenegger said about it. He's my lawyer, and he abused privilege.
Uh-oh.
Isn't he the state, isn't he the people's lawyer?
I thought so. I thought so also that Arnold himself, the Gropinator, has hired a private investigator, right? But he says that he won't make to investigate himself.
That's right. But now that he's heard what the attorney general had to say, he's not going to share the info.
Right.
You know, I liked Arnold the one time I met him personally.
Yeah.
But since he's been a politician, been a politician, and I don't think much of them.
Did he grope you?
He did not grope me, and I got to actually see him in nothing but his, Speedo.
Well, that's a lot more than some of the photos that are circulating around.
I haven't seen those.
You know, he posed for Robert Mapplethorpe.
Oh, right, I did hear that. Yeah. But I didn't, of course, being the kind of guy I am, I didn't rush right onto the Internet to see them.
Well, you know what? I read this, I can't remember, it was Maureen Dowd. She had this column saying these Republicans have emerged as kind of like this century's version of the 1960s Rat Pack. I mean, if you think about all the crimes and misdemeanors and, Rush Limbaugh, druggie, right?
Yeah.
Arnold,
a lot of them have sexual peccadilloes.
Yeah, right. William Bennett, who is this national scold telling us all we're so bad, turns out to be a compulsive gambler.
And also he tries to tell us which noxious weed to smoke.
Oh, yeah, all of them do.
You know, I wanted to ask you about two things while I have you.
Did you know that the Democrats, they had that MTV debate, and they said, how many of you are willing to say that you smoked marijuana? And I think it was Dean, Kerry, and Edwards who say, I did. And don't tell me we're finally beyond that. And they didn't say, they always say, I experimented with marijuana.
Right. I always say, show me the picture of the lab coat you were wearing while you were experimenting.
Well, Billy from Santa Cruz, let me ask you a question. Have you ever experimented with marijuana?
I wasn't experimenting, my friend. I was working on professional status.
Kids, do not try this at home.
And you know, that's what I want to say about today, because you know what? The last 50 years, America has fought two wars. One was a war against this Castro guy in Cuba, where we haven't let anything through, supposedly, and he's been the longest guy in control of anything. The only thing talk about a war we lost. This thing with Castro, it's the craziest thing imaginable, and the drug war.
Ryan.
You can score this marijuana stuff on any corner, at least in Santa Cruz.
Really?
And I think every other city, town, and dale of this country. So we've spent these billions and billions, and we keep doing things that just don't work. What the hell's going on with us?
I don't know. We'll leave that one open. Thank you, Billy from Santa Cruz. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF, anywhere that you're listening. Some people, anybody listening outside of North America? Send me an email. It's nightcall@WRIF.com. Or you can call in 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to another line. Hi, Peter Werby with you on WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
My name is Rob. I'm calling from Taylor.
Okay.
I've been calling and listening to you for a long time.
Great.
I was calling to ask what your idea or viewpoints were on that. Big police raid at that school they've been showing the footage of on the news all week.
Well,
couple days.
Doesn't that just lend itself to what Billy from Santa Cruz said about the drug war? It's come to insanity like that we have a SWAT raid on, was it high school now?
Yeah.
On high school kids with guns at their head, handcuffed. Didn't they have dogs in there as well?
Well, they didn't even make a single bust.
No, and there nobody had the evil weed, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
I couldn't believe it. I mean, they had guns in kids' faces, and they're, I mean, I can see being prepared, but that's like about as overzealous as you can get, I think.
I think so. I'll tell you what, Rob, if my that happened to my kid, of course, and I think almost any of us would be furious, but, you know, our daughter, our son would come home and say, Dad, that's the worst thing that ever had me. I was so frightened. You know, we had saw these guns, dogs, handcuffs, and I would say, you know what, Junior? They've just bought your college education. Do you know how many lawsuits that school district is going to be facing?
Oh, and the police are defending it like they think that was the best and the only thing that they could have done.
Yeah. Well,
I could not believe that when I saw that on the news. It was
one of the things is, I mean, I'm thinking about people now that are 14 or 15. So they're going to be able to say in 50 years, look back at this era. Yeah, and it's going to look so insane if there's still a history, you know, if there's still a civilization and what have you, and they're gonna you know, all this stuff is recorded, right? So, like this event where they cops raided the school, where was it? North Carolina or something like that?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're gonna almost probably show it for comedy relief. The people in those days were so crazed about intoxication that they, you know, and then they would tell this story and people go, boy, they were crazy back then. And I think enough of us increasingly, Rob, think that today that these people running things, the John Ashcrofts and, you know, these school boards and these crazy cops that would do that to kids are crazy. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your call. Thanks for listening. Hi, this is WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, how are you? This is Barb from Royal Oak calling.
Hi, Barb.
How are you tonight?
I am good. Thank you for calling.
Good. I have a couple public service announcements, sort of.
Good. I'm the public service director for WRIF. Yeah.
I don't know if you or the audience knows this, but the employees at Flagship Border Store in Ann Arbor started a strike yesterday morning.
Yes, indeed.
Against their pretty evil union busting type Borders Incorporated.
And oh, Barb, come on. Just because the CEO of Borders makes $23 million a year and he's trying to keep his employees at $9.50 an hour.
You only get $9.50 an hour if you're full time and you've worked there for about 8 years. Everybody else gets $6.50 an hour.
Really?
$6.50 an hour. They are evil. I think that's under the Ann Arbor Living Wage Ordinance laws, but when the Borders management was told that, what they said was a living wage was a romantic notion.
Oh, wow.
They've obviously never tried to live on that kind of money. But Borders in the city of Detroit opened this weekend, and there will be a picket tomorrow morning. If anybody is up and about at 8 o'clock in the morning, the Borders in the new CompuWare building, there's going to be a picket called by the UFCW, who's the union organizing the Borders workers.
United Food and Commercial Workers, right?
That's the one.
Yeah, right. Well, if you go to my website, folks, because the Borders Strikers website address is a little long, you can go to mine, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe. W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerbe.com, and you can link onto there, and it says, Workers Strike Borders Books, Boycott Borders Books Until They Recognize Their Union. I mean, it is just, my lip curls whenever I think of the public presentation that Borders has for itself. You know, they're interested in books, they're interested in ideas, and then you look and it's like any other cutthroat corporation trying to screw their workers so they can pay their CEO some super inflated wage that he never even could spend.
It's ridiculous. Their new sign that they put up at the building is a big huge picture of a doggy, you know, a nice family type doggy that, you know, people at Borders probably couldn't afford to buy dog food for their dogs on the wages that they make, let alone raise a family. But it's a pretty hypocritical face that they're putting on.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty bad.
Now, at $9.50 an hour, that's the top of the wage structure for Borders. That's less than $20,000 a year.
And you're required, really, to know quite a bit about literature, about
sure.
not just, you know, American literature, but about world literature and fine books. And you're really, these are librarian skills at Burger King wages.
Mm-hmm.
Not to insult anybody that works at Burger King either, because they work a lot harder than any CEO I've ever heard of.
Yeah, and they should have a union, and they should be making union wages as well.
Well, everybody that wants one, and 93% of the workers at the store voted to represent the union, so it seems pretty clear that they wish to be represented by a union, and how it would hurt the company is just kind of beyond me, except it's about control.
Well, you know, part of it is, yeah. I mean, they are control freaks. Why? You would think, man, you know, think about this. I mean, I guess they don't care if, the, you know, these CEOs or the management in general, if they're loved by the peasantry that that labors for them. But think about this, Barbara. If I was the CEO, I'm making $23 million a year, then year after year, of course, I can't spend even, you know, 10% of that probably. And I would think, you know what? Why don't I have everybody working at Borders make about $35,000 or $40,000 a year and tie it exactly to profitability? And instead of being this hated figure, I would be, you know, loved as the beneficent ruler of Borders.
And all he'd really have to do is learn how to get by on like $10-15 million a year.
Yeah, right. Well,
I really think I know I could do it.
$30,000 to $40,000 would take a big cut, but so he might wind up only making like $3 million or something like that.
Oh, you know what?
That.
That's, and we couldn't ask that. That would just be done right on America.
Yeah, it sounds like a bunch of commie propaganda to me. Would really probably erode his what do they always call it? Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, yeah, if you had to take like a $20 million cut in your pay, I mean if I was only making $3 million, I'd find it tough to get out of bed, huh?
I don't know. I think I could struggle through it, but
yeah.
I know that I am not going to help him make his $23 million this year until these people get a contract. I'm not going to any Borders or Walden Books or Amazon.com.
What's Amazon?
Amazon handles, if you order a book through Amazon, that's where they get it from.
Really?
They have a symbiotic relationship. So
isn't that about amoebas or something? Hey, what you said? In fact, I got to get the spots pretty quickly. What you said? You had a second public
one.
Service novel.
And this is far more fun and wonderful. Is the Tell Us the Truth tour starring Billy Bragg, Steve Earle, Mike Mills from REM, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine and Audioslave, and Lester Chambers from the Chambers Brothers are going to play at the Royal Oak Music Theater Tuesday night. And it's going to be about activism in music and media diversity and fair trade. And it's going to be, I don't even know how to describe how this sounds, but talk and music and fun. And there will be tables from local activist groups to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And for the low price of $25.
Yeah, this is going to be a great show, and I'm going to see it in Miami as well, because the Tell Us the Truth tour, and I think you can go to tellusthetruth.org, am I correct?
Yep.
Yeah, that's on my website as well, peterwerby.com, including the information about the tour stopping at the Royal Oak Music Theater on this Tuesday. And, you know, one thing actually you forgot to mention, I was looking at my website right now, there's going to be a Strikers benefit tomorrow night at the Arc in Ann Arbor.
That's absolutely true, starring Chris Buhalis, who's a wonderful labor singer.
He is indeed. So lots of things going on. I can barely keep track of it. That's why these websites are real important, and also it's really important. And we appreciate it that people like yourself, Barbara, call up and tell us. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night now, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Mamma Mia's, located conveniently inside the Quality Suites in downtown Windsor. Center. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roach, put your best pace and body forward with help from Dr. Roach.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Some addictions can be cured. Jane's Addiction. Live in concert. Jane's Addiction. Live. Saturday, December 27th at the Palace. Brought to you in part by Budweiser.
Pick up the new album, Strays, in stores now.
Jane's Addiction. The live concert event. Jane's Addiction. With very special guest, Marilyn Manson.
Marilyn Manson.
And the Used. Tickets on sale now at cc.com, palacenet.com, at the Palace box office and all Ticketmaster ticket centers. Or charge by phone at 248-645-6666. Saturday, December 27th at the Palace. James Addiction Live.
It's Metro Power Sports' colossal Fall Outdoorsman sale going on now. All Hondas and ATVs are being sold for the first time ever at or below invoice for 1 week only. Honda's the standard for quality and performance. Just check out these deals. Honda's flagship, the 650 Rincon, was $75.99, now just $57.95.
Unbelievable!
Honda Rancher 350 was $49.00, now just $29.99.
Shut up!
And the Honda Recon was $38.99, now just $26.99.
What are you smoking?
I'm not done. Save thousands on Honda's all-new Rancher 4000 with GPS on board. And bring in your hunting license and receive an additional 20% off Honda line accessories for your ATV. Honda ATVs for Junior are also on sale. VTX is from $89.99 and get $1,000 in free accessories on select models. Interest rates as low as 3.9% to qualified buyers. Don't miss out. It's Metro Power Sports' colossal Fall Outdoorsman sale going on right now. Metro Power Sports is located on Michigan Avenue in Canton. Honda, performance first.
When the moment has to be truly special, just remember these love matters.
J.B. Robinson.
You know what happens when you give her an amazing holiday gift from J.B. Robinson Jewelers? You instantly become the guy other women use as an example. As in, did you see what Bob gave Beth? Why can't you be more like that? Which is good. For over 70 years, the experts at JBR have been, well, experts at helping guys like you find the perfect gift. They ask the right questions and have all the right answers. Like an extensive selection of beautiful three-stone diamond rings in round or princess cut. Collections starting from $299.99 to $7,000. Plus, while love comes with no guarantee, JBR has a 90-day money-back guarantee. Just remember these love letters.
Shop J.B. Robinson Jewelers, 9 convenient locations. Free financing for 1 year available. Minimum purchase and minimum monthly payments required.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. Talking about lots of stuff. Bush's lies about Iraq as more of our soldiers die. Thousands have died Iraqis and Americans because of Bush's lies about an unnecessary and illegal war, becoming even clearer that it was absolutely unnecessary. An abortion bill signed that will be sure to be overturned. The men have decided that women shall not have a particular form of abortion, although the method used is also used in other abortion procedures. So this is one of the reasons it's going to be overturned. I mean, part of this is just a bone being thrown to the rabid right, who thinks that politically you can intervene into the reproductive process of women. Yeah, can't do it. Even if you make abortion illegal, women still have abortions. You know, there's only a few countries in North America and South America where abortion is legal. If I am correct, I think it is Canada, the United States, and Cuba, the only places. But women have abortions in every other country in Latin America. Bush also urging the Middle East to embrace democracy. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you. It'd be like Al Capone talking about law and order saying, well, I think we ought to follow the law in every regard. I mean, you have a situation, as I said, where we're discovering more and more that Bush absolutely lied about going to war in Iraq and the necessity and how it was Iraq was an immediate threat. Find out now that Iraq was sending very strong signals that they were willing to let the United States virtually do anything it wanted. But Bush wanted this war. Bush absolutely wanted this war. And was the main fear in the Bush administration was that something would occur to not allow the military invasion that we saw take place. Now, Bush now urges the Middle East to embrace democracy. He has urged Middle East leaders from Iran to Syria, which isn't very far, to embrace democracy. And he didn't mention Egypt, who we send I can't even begin to add up how many billions of dollars we've sent to this dictatorship and to this absolutist royal government in Saudi Arabia. I mean, the billions and billions and billions that have gone to just Saudi Arabia and Egypt alone of our tax dollars. And Bush is saying we've made a mistake for the last 60 years. Well, yeah, your dad, made a real bad mistake supporting Saddam Hussein. But anyways, what he's saying is we ought to have, U.S.-style democracy. I mean, like here in the United States, where elections are really no more than auctions being sold off to the highest bidder, corporate bidder, really, because you and I don't figure in the process very much. Bush trying to raise $180 million. $180 million for his reelection campaign. And essentially what he's getting isn't contributions, but investments by corporations that they realize then will be paid off, just like Bush has been paying off all these corporate contributors over the last 3 years, once that they see Bush is reelected. And maybe we could use an example of the 2000 election. See, this is the way it would go in Iran and Syria. You have an election, and the guy that comes in second, because of the muscle, the political muscle he has with the court system and the governor of a particular region and the person that's in charge of the voting of a particular region, decides you're going to be the president. Doesn't matter who wins. The person that wins is shuffled off to obscurity, and the person with all the pull, with all the connections with the governor and the secretary of state of the region and the high court of the particular country, that's who decides the election. The vote be damned. This is the model that George W. Bush is suggesting for the Middle East. And when you look at all these other countries like Egypt, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, where our tax dollars are going to these absolutely undemocratic governments. I mean, it's just an absolute bad joke. Here, this was in Reuters. Indignant Arabs say Bush democracy speech a sham. Of course it is. All right, let's go back to your phones. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening. It's Peter Werby with you.
Hey, what's going on? I was wondering if I could get a 20-minute segment with you like Barb got to, or are you just going to cut off somebody that doesn't agree with you?
You never can tell, but you're getting close to going bye-bye as it is, so I would start and use your time.
All righty. I was wondering what you think, I'm curious why you think that there is a right-wing media bias, and besides Foxhole News, as you call it, what other right-wing media outlets do you assume that we're getting all our viewpoints from?
Well, let me just tell you, let me speak a little about giving Barb 20 minutes, which I think was about six. It probably just seemed like that because you're so unused to hearing anybody on the medium that has politics to the left of Mussolini, and it probably is uncomfortable. Now, when and if Rush Limbaugh ever gets out of rehab, you'll have that voice again. Now, talk radio in this country is dominated by the far right wing. Not even by kind of, the little right of center, but far right wing, voices. And it's a stranglehold virtually on this, whereas more than half the country voted not for the guy that George Bush and Michael Reagan and Sean Hannity backed, but rather the guy that actually won. That's who the majority of people in this country backed. And how many radio stations have left of center talk show hosts?
Not that many, or there's on the internet, such as yourself. But I mean,
Why do you think that is? Why do you think, for instance, WJR at noon has Rush Limbaugh, like when if he's not just stoned out of his mind, or when he comes out of rehab, but Rush Limbaugh is broadcasting from the Fisher Building on a station in a city that voted 95% for Al Gore and Ralph Nader. And the immediate broadcasting area of the county surrounding Detroit all voted for Al Gore. And yet they decided, we're going to put on a far right-wing guy who we understand now, or at least suggest the possibility that all of his opinions could have been distorted by all these baby blues that he was tossing down and how he acquired in an illegal manner, right?
Can I talk?
Well, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not sure though. Like, I know there's Nielsen ratings for the TV. I don't know what you guys call it for the radio.
Arbitron.
Arbitron. Wouldn't they shut him down if he was so unpopular in Michigan?
Wouldn't you have
Arbitron ratings to say, seems here that Peter Werby's getting more ratings than Rush Limbaugh. Let's put him on WJR.
You know what? I could kick Rush Limbaugh's ass in the ratings in Detroit. That's what I think.
No, I'm sure you could, but I'm just saying what.
So why would they have him on? Well, you know why? Because they might not even get any advertisers. That's another consideration. Having Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and what have you, some of these guys that are really freaky right-wingers, they're safe bets because they can say anything about anybody. They can make the most toxic remarks about people of color, about immigrants, about women, about laboring people, anything under the sun, and they get away with it. I, by the way, and some people know this, and I've mentioned it once or twice, I had a nationally syndicated talk show, and I did it from October 2000 till the end of June of this year. And it was I was able to keep this job because there was I didn't broadcast into this area. I didn't compete with WRIF, and I had mostly small towns in the South, the Southwest, and the West. But to be quite honest, never enough to justify eventually being paid by this network. You say, well, look, Pete, you're not popular. You can't do it. Well, the truth is, in every city that actually I did broadcast, the program was wildly popular, to the point that I did broadcast into Santa Cruz, where Billy, the first caller, called from, in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And hey, if people are listening in Santa Fe, hello. I was out there last year, and the mayor of the city of Santa Fe declared it Peter Werby Day in Santa Fe. This would work anywhere. The show that I have, or anybody like me, would work anywhere. People are starving in this country to stop hearing the sound of the right hand clapping and clapping itself on the back. But there is virtually, as Hillary said, this vast right-wing conspiracy that is so terrified of full debate between the left and the right because they know they would get blown away. They know that they would lose their shorts.
Why is Fox so popular then?
It doesn't. It's not wildly popular. I mean,
well, out of the, you know what I'm saying? Then.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's got what? Well, you know, you see, it's about like a million point one people listening. There, listen, there is about a third of the population, if you seem to listen to the show because you know some of my pet phrases, it's a third of the people that can be fooled all the time, and they want to be fooled all the time. They want support for the right-wing views that that they have. They need this ammunition. They're in a polemic against reality. Everything, you know, the facts of the real world are in complete opposition to the mean-spirited, warmongering, punitive, angry attitudes they have about the world. So we live in an era now where we talk about diversity, tolerance, that there should be love among people. That's not the way they want to approach the world. They kind of like the way it is, filled with poverty, disease, but maybe they have a little niche. So, and some people, I mean, you would think, Jesus, I mean, don't they understand that they're being fleeced by these, you know, wealthy characters that jack them around with stuff like gun control and, you know, and abortion and what have you. But, you know, they need these multimillionaires that sleep in the White House like, you know, the pill-popping conservative, you know, spokesperson, Rush Limbaugh. Maybe that's where he got his name, Rush. You ever think about that? Why would you even take anything seriously that this guy is so wedded to the powerful and wealthy and a multimillionaire himself that he had the capacity to speak at anything having to do with ordinary people? Huh? Well, I don't know. You didn't answer me. Maybe you're gone. I gave you more time than Barbara. All right. Our next caller is where? Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Peter. This is Dan. I'm calling from White Lake.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. I was wondering what your opinion was on the suicide bombings that took place over in Saudi Arabia.
Well, seemed like bad thing. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I think it's a bad thing. I'm just curious why we're in bed with them so much.
With the Saudis, you mean?
Yeah.
Why do you think? They got a lot of oil. They're willing to give us bases to protect oil interests in the Middle East. Sure. I mean, that's why is the United States involved in the Middle East at all? I mean, why would we? I mean, you know, there ought to be some responsibility for the world community, you know, as the way the you know what happens in the world. But why does the United States take unilateral action in so many places? It's all because of commercial and corporate interests. And that's the only reason that the United States has expended probably $1 trillion in the Middle East over the last 50 years or 60 years.
Yeah, to me it just don't make no sense how every day you can listen to the news or the radio and they talk about Saudi Arabia as our ally, but most of the terrorists came from there. You know, they support the radical Wahhabism and
sure.
Totally oppress females. And that, to me, they're just as bad as Iraq, Iran, Egypt. But yet they, you know, the Bush administration and everyone else says that they're our allies. And now, you know, they're getting bombed themselves by Al-Qaeda, you know, and Al-Qaeda was, Al-Qaeda actually came from there. That's where Osama bin Laden came from. And I just find it real ironic how, you know, we can call them our allies, but I don't really think they are. You know, I think, you know, they're over there, even their schools, you know, their schools don't recognize Israel on none of their maps. They don't have no recognition for world order, it don't seem like. They're just focused on, you know, building some kind of, you know, I don't know, the best way to say it is like, I don't know.
Oil.
I think it goes beyond oil. I think it goes to, you know, they want Islam worldwide as the dominant religion, you know. I don't know. Personally, I think the whole oil thing, you know, that's getting old. I think we're on a roadmap going to the hydrogen, you know.
The Bush administration has reduced all sorts of funding for any alternative you know, sources of energy. They still want us locked in to our addiction to oil. And that's what it's all about. That's what it's been about from the beginning. And I think the Saudis are a little nervous because I think the long-range strategy of conquering Iraq, which had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, nothing to do with how horrible Saddam Hussein was, nothing to do with anything other than controlling the strategic reserves that lie under those countries. And if you go back into the history of, I mean, even back as far as World War I, but just even recent history with Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia, the United States under the absolute craven policies of this gang that's made up of Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Armitage and all these guys like that, they want a stable country that the United States directly controls, you know, in an imperial manner, to sitting on top of oil. And they're worried about Saudi Arabia. You know, they've lost control of Iran because of their, you know, the mistaken policy of supporting the Shah of Iran back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And the Saudis probably figure their days are numbered. Just like, you know, when you're in a company and all the management saying, you know, hey, Dan, you're doing a great job and all that. And behind your back, they're saying, yeah, we got to get rid of him. We got to cut it. You know, got to cut him out of the picture. Same thing. Saudis are in the crosshairs to eventually move them out of there. I got to move out of here. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. One more call before our break. Hi, it's Peter Werby at 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing tonight?
Doing good.
Good. I was just wondering how you think it's okay for someone to kill an unborn fetus, which I'm not really, you know, for or against. I really could care less, but Bush can't send people to soldiers to Iraq to free millions of people that are under a dictatorship.
You think that's why he sent people to Iraq?
Hey, it really doesn't matter. It's,
well, they're not.
You think it's okay to kill a fetus?
Well, you know, wait a minute now. You think that, you've got an odd view of biology. Fetuses that are a dependent part of a woman's body, you know, that does not enjoy personhood in any regard other than in some people's theology, which they're welcome to, and they should deal with that by not having abortions. But women that don't see things like that, and women historically and even, you know, in the prehistory have always had ways of ending pregnancies that they didn't want. And you're talking about a war of aggression and a war for oil and a war for empire, and you consider that the same thing?
Hey, it's your rationale.
I don't have any irrationale. I'm not having an abortion. What?
The way you want to rationalize it.
Wait, I don't even understand what you mean. I'm not having an abortion. I'm just saying that this audit, that the reproduction process has to do with families. That's what Roe v. Wade was based upon. That it was an invasion of the privacy of women and women's families to have the political state make a medical procedure an illegal act. So, I mean, if you want the government to intervene in that process, I mean, I don't even know what to say. What's your rationale or rationalization?
You said a bunch of courts struck it down. Which ones were they? The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California?
No, state courts, any number of state courts have declared that this laws that say that they're aimed at these partial, so-called partial birth abortions are in fact a manner of trying to stop a very common procedure for second, you know, for second trimester abortion. So the law, as it was passed, has been routinely overruled by state and federal courts, and it doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of passing until they get some of the, unless they get some of these right wing creatures that into the judiciary that are so out of step with the American public, but are part of the far right wing agenda of George Bush.
Okay, and you keep talking about huge corporations. Which huge corporations are you talking about? The Rockefellers, who fund 98% of all your liberal,
what,
or your loving liberal NAACP.
Why do you have that kind of sarcasm when you say loving?
Audubon Society.
What's your problem with the Audubon Society?
I know, but it's a large corporation that you hate.
Well, you know what? Corporations do, and a number of them do have, philanthropy as part of their, programs. But the pharmaceutical companies that maintain this inflated price for all the drugs that you and I pay, and if you've got older parents or grandparents that are getting ripped off, all of these big coal burning and oil burning factories that George W. Bush has just said, oh, hey, we're not even going to put you under the Clean Air Act anymore because you contributed so much to my campaign funds. We're going to drop 50 lawsuits that they have against these power plants saying you're poisoning the people of the United States. You're creating an epidemic of asthma against our children. And George Bush says, I don't care because you're going to give us another 10 million, aren't you? That's okay, huh?
So if there are billionaires that contribute to what you agree with, then billionaires are fine. But if they go against...
Well, I know what you're saying. No, that's not the way I'd pose it in the slightest. Obviously, somebody like, the whole distribution of wealth in this country is so out of whack. The fact that you have 70, 80, 90 million people that qualify as poor in the wealthiest country in the world, that you have tens of millions of people without health insurance, that you have millions of children in at risk for hunger or have actually gone to bed hungry, is an absolute disgrace and a crime. It's like the 19th century. We're going backwards. That we have an infant mortality rate in the Detroit area, in some areas of Detroit, that's comparable to Bangladesh. Gotta go.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
Hey. What's everyone doing here?
Todd, sit down. We gotta talk.
What?
We know you're using prepaid wireless.
I don't believe this. Give me my prepaid card.
Let it go, Todd. Don't you see the AT&T Wireless Go Phone service is better than prepaid? There's still no annual contract or credit check, and rates are as low as 10 cents a minute on the $39.99 plan. That's less than half of most prepaid rates.
What is this?
Plus, you get unlimited nights and weekends. Lots of anytime minutes, all in the AT&T Wireless National Network.
And you get a cool phone with up to a $50 mail-in rebate.
Even at M-Mode service to get the internet, email, music.
Oh, man, I'm such an idiot.
Thanks, Todd, because I didn't want to have to say it.
AT&T Wireless Go Phone. Call 1-866-REACH-OUT for more information. Visit an AT&T Wireless store or click attwireless.com for special online deals. Reach out on the wireless service America trusts. AT&T Wireless.
Geographic limitations, device compatibility, and other charges, terms, and restrictions apply. Deposit amounts expire in 30 days. Additional charges apply to M-Mode service rates compared to national plans. See store for details.
During FunJet Vacations Bring a Friend sale, you can save up to $200 on a romantic getaway to Couples Ocho Rios in Jamaica. Couples resorts feature ultra-inclusive vacations with gourmet meals, premium drinks, unlimited activities such as golf, tennis, windsurfing, and much more. Imagine snorkeling and scuba diving in Jamaica's crystal clear waters, soaking up the warm sun poolside, rejuvenating with full spa treatments, and golfing to your heart's content at one of the best resorts in the Caribbean. With FunJet Vacations, you can save up to $200 and also enjoy morning departures and Sunday nonstop flights from Detroit Metro to Jamaica. To plan your FunJet Vacations getaway this winter and save up to $200 at Couples Ocho Rios, contact your local travel agent. Call 1-800-FUNJET FunJet1 for a recommended agent or visit funjet.com. That's 1-800-FUNJET1 or funjet.com.
The $200 savings per reservation is valid on select 7-night February and March vacations at Couples Ocho Rios via Ryan International Airlines. International taxes and fees are not included. Restrictions apply. See the FunJet Vacations Bill of Rights regarding cancellations and refunds.
Sunday nights rock at the Hot Rock Cafe.
Only the best live local bands that the Motor City has to offer are on stage for you. Sunday nights at the Hot Rock in Warren. Join Screamin' Scott Randall from 101 WRIF tonight for the most outrageous Sunday night party in Metro Detroit. Only at the Hot Rock Cafe.
Get yourself a little rock and roll ear candy with the Motor City's very own Craycraft. Take in a feast for the eyes with the Hot Rock's Hot Bod Contest. Pick up on killer riff giveaways. Plus, the first 101 people through the door will score a pair of
tickets to see Rat in concert November 14th at the Royal Oak Music Theater.
Knock back great $2 bottle beers and get your hands on the Hot Rocks Awesome Shot specials all throughout the night. Don't forget, it's happening tonight with The Riff. Come on out and party with The Riff's Scott Randall and hear live local rock from Breakpoint. It's all going down at the Hot Rock Cafe.
The Hot Rock Cafe on Hoover Road just south of 10 Mile and Ward.
Sunday night's rock at the Hot Rock Cafe.
Frankie, we never go out anymore.
What do you mean, doll?
I mean this relationship is bombsville.
Want to have some real fun? I just heard about this swanky event at MGM Grand.
What's this clam bake called?
It's the Carnival of Cash and Cars. MGM Grand is giving away 10 big cash prizes every week, plus 6 brand new cars.
Cold hard cash and hot new cars? Sounds like my kind of carnival.
Cruise on into MGM Grand and enter to win 1 of 6 hot new cars, including a Chrysler Crossfire and Ford F-150 XLT. Plus, big cash prizes every Thursday and Sunday. Swipe your Players Club card for your free entry. Earn additional entries playing all slots and table games 4 a.m. Sunday through 4 a.m. Thursday.
Ring-a-ding-ding. I feel like the luckiest gal in the world.
And dig this. With my Players Club card, we could be driving home in a brand new car.
Your aces, Frankie.
And your platinum, pussycat.
Be there this Sunday for the Carnivals of Cash and Cars drawing. Only at MGM Grand Detroit Casino.
See Players Club for official rules and details.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. Did you get the sarcasm in that last conservative caller's voice, the loving NAACP in the Audubon Society, dripping with contempt for people that are trying to make some sense of the world and offering, absolutely offering, some positive solutions? Remember, I've always said that when you talk to conservatives and you ask them what's wrong with the world, the only thing they'll tell you is wrong with the world is that liberals exist. Not even liberals, anybody to the left of Mussolini. Heard that phrase before too, right? That's what's wrong with the world. And so they would... Someone like him would even criticize a mainstream environmental group like the Audubon Society that often does good work, but sometimes a little tepid in its approach, at least in my estimation, given the incredible force of the assault on the natural world. Hey, get this. This is from Dateline Miami. Even as thousands of U.S. troops are stationed in war zones abroad, plans for Veterans Day parades across the country are being scaled back or scrapped. The problem, not enough troops, tanks, and Humvees to wow the patriotic crowds. The military has 131,000 troops deployed in Iraq. They're talking about calling up another 43,000 National Guardsmen. Here's what I predict. There's going to be revolts in the military, just like there was in Vietnam. One thing about Vietnam, that the casualty rate was so disproportionately on the side of the country the United States invaded, Vietnam, that if there were 200, I mean, in a week you'd have like 200 Americans killed, but there'd be like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 Vietnamese killed. Yeah, I know, most of it was civilians, but still, there were certainly Viet Cong fighters and North Vietnamese Army regulars that were killed at quite a clip as well. Here, it seems, almost an opposite ratio, unfortunately, on both sides. As horrendous as every death is, that has not reached that scale. But who knows? Who knows what's going on? This is exactly, there's people are saying it's not Vietnam, they don't have a sanctuary in the north, they're not being supplied by the Soviet Union, there's not this mass insurgency the way there was in Vietnam. But still, when you see this every day, 1, 2, 6, 16 American troops, and now there's starting to be the indiscriminate bombing of areas that they think may contain insurgents, like in Tikrit. And it's increasingly looking like a combination of Vietnam, the Israeli army in Palestine, inner city cops in a ghetto area. It's just too ugly. And even if you want to ascribe the best motives, and I don't think there was a single good motive coming out of this illegitimate government that ought to be removed as quickly as possible by the constitutional provision of impeachment. I don't think there's one iota of good intent on any of these people. It's all just for the rubes. Oh, the weapons of mass destruction. Oh, yeah. No, okay, now we're going to liberate the people. Oh, now we're going to create democracy in the region. It's a bunch of BS. They want to get through the next election so they can carry out their full right-wing agenda to totally alter the nature of this country. And you think there's problems now? I mean, I almost say, yeah, re-elect George W. Bush. And they go, okay, we got it all now. You know, now it's just full steam ahead. And we're going to get Jeb in there in 2008. This country will fall apart. It'll be close to civil war. There'll be chaos in the streets. There'll be the kind of political turmoil that, you know, that will make this country an almost unlivable place. I don't mean it's going to, you know, like wars or, you know, the U.S. Civil War or anything like that. But we got to dispatch these people by every legal means possible immediately. And that's there. George W. Bush lost the 2000 election. He has no right even to be sitting in the White House, let alone carrying out a right-wing agenda. He's not a unifier, like he said in 2000. He's a far right-wing religious conservative that has an agenda that is supported by about 20% of the population. And good numbers of us have no idea what he's up to, that haven't seen the catastrophic results that have already resulted from what he's put in place. All right, moving onward. It's line one, is it? All right, thank you. Rick Fox will be on the air at 2 a.m. 1 a.m., we'll have a couple of interviews for you, so stay tuned for that. Hi, it's WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hello, Mr. Werby. How are you this evening?
Good, good.
It's Scott Bennett calling from Chatham, Ontario, Canada.
Hi, Scott.
Hi. First-time caller. I've been listening for a couple of years now.
Welcome.
There's a program on the TV there. I know you don't watch much TV. Last week on the CBC, it was a program called The National. I guess it's much like your 60 Minutes type of thing.
I'm aware of it, yeah. It comes real close to what would make me watch television.
Yeah.
Of course it is. You can see it on Channel 9, right?
Yeah. There was
in Windsor.
There was an excellent piece, about an hour long, on the financial relationship between the Bush family and the Bin Ladens.
Sure.
And it was brilliant. It was almost subversive. You know, in nature. I've never thought I'd see anything like that. But it explained how, you know, the Bin Ladens maintained an office building in Houston and, you know, the close family relationship that George W. And the senior both have with the Bin Ladens. And what I found particularly interesting that I'd never heard before is when 9/11 happened, they had all the airplanes grounded, with the exception of three or four flights that contained all of the Bin Laden family members that were in North America. They were allowed to leave.
Without having any questions asked of them or no questions, interrogation, anything. You're Bin Laden, get him in a plane, fly him back to Saudi Arabia.
And it was kept very, very quiet.
Yeah. Also, this all ties in to this large holding corporation called the Carlyle Group that involves Bush's father.
Yeah.
And the chairman, formerly, no longer, but up to just recently, was Frank Carlucci. Who was all? Was this all in there?
There was mention of it, yes.
Yeah, and so Carlucci was a Secretary of Defense. I'm trying to remember. It was either under? I think it was under Bush. May have been under Reagan. No, I think it was under Bush. And Carlucci then became the head of the Carlyle Group. So on September 11th. Carlucci is meeting with the head of the Bin Laden family.
Yeah.
So it's, and again, I don't mean to say that, you know, some people have put this forth as to show that the conspiracy that the Bush administration was directly involved in, in September 11th. I don't think that at all. But the cozy relationship that works for them to make billions of dollars in their so-called, they're not defense contracts, they're war contracts. Mm-hmm. When Bush came off, you remember that, I don't know, since you're in Canada, I don't know how much you see all this, but Bush had this phony stunt that he pulled where they flew him onto this aircraft carrier.
Oh, yeah.
And then the next day, Bush visited this United, I can't remember the name of it now, United Technologies, United Defense, or something like that, and, you know, to tell them what a wonderful job they'd all done in preparing these weapons of war to destroy Iraq even more. And this was a Carlyle Group a company.
Mm.
So essentially what happens is the more that Bush carries out policies of war, the more the Carlyle Group gets contracts and enriches themselves, the more that it enriches himself, the more it enriches his father. And when his father passes away, all this money is going to be passed on to Bush. So this is thoroughly corrupt. I mean, even if it's not directly corrupt, it certainly has the appearance of an impropriety, of a set of relationships that that just look real bad. And I think they not only look real bad, I think they look real bad because they are real bad.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, I agree completely.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for making our program international.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And, oh, yeah, I wanted to, let's see, where is that now? Speaking of international, this from Ben Birch, the webmaster of WhiteRoseSociety.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to Ben and WhiteRoseSociety.org because they archive this program. And it's now goes into 92 countries. And he says, I wonder how many more have internet access. The other thing is that the, you know, tomorrow if you miss some of the show or you want to call up at 313-298-WRIF and you go to WhiteRoseSociety.org and there's the archive and you can hear yourself. All right. Thank you very much for our next call. Rick Fox, and let's go on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, my name is Lance. And, how you doing?
Good. Lance it is?
Yeah, that's it.
Hi, Lance.
So I was just kind of curious of what the motive, you know, was behind John Ashcroft going after, you know, Tommy Chong to put him in jail for selling bombs, you know. I mean, it was a big nationwide thing, but he was the most famous and the old one, you know, and I just don't understand it. I can't comprehend what they were thinking.
Well, here they had this big bust of paraphernalia, and Tommy Chong apparently was selling bongs, which is a like a water pipe, which you can smoke marijuana or hash in. So, I mean, there was no, I mean, I don't even get this. I mean, there was no narcotics involved, or
right.
I hate to even call it narcotics, but illegal drugs. So Tommy Chong gets sent to the joint, and Rush Limbaugh, who is involved with buying all sorts of illegal prescription drugs, he's off in a rehab, right?
Exactly my point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, he gets a free pass because he's somebody, and then this guy, you know, he's pretty much an icon in the counterculture.
Sure.
And they just, like, kind of single him out and put him away, you know? I mean, like, oh, it's only for one use, you know? But you can smoke it out of anything. You can put it in a paper. You can use tinfoil, you know? If you want to get high, you're going to get high. A bong is only just something fun, you know? That's my view.
Well, thank you so much, Lance, right. I appreciate it. Yeah, to free Tommy Chong, you know, send Rush Limbaugh to jail. He's one of the few drug abusers. And you know, when you're doing that kind, there's drug use and there's drug abuse. Rush Limbaugh is a drug abuser. And normally I would say that people that abuse drugs need, are like, you know, that conservative caller who contemptuously and, you know, sarcastically said, the loving Audubon Society, that we ought to extend in a general way a loving care of our community to people that that have problems with drugs or alcohol or even cigarettes, not put them in jail. And yet Rush Limbaugh has scoffed at everybody from people that have had the identical problems like him. Kitty Dukakis has ridiculed people that we've lost in the rock and roll community like Kurt Cobain and Jerry Garcia. And said that people that that abuse the drug laws ought to be sent to jail. Rush, you need a vacation. Why do you think they call him Rush? Brian writes in to nightcall at WRIF.com. Would you stop embarrassing yourself by telling us you could kick Rush Limbaugh's ass? Jesus, Pete, you don't get it. The country is made up of Republicans and Democrats, and then there's a 25% of the population who thinks like you. Quit insulting the Dems by trying to lump yourself with them. You're nothing but an old, selfish, childless hippie who hates anyone who's achieved more success than himself. I feel sorry for you, but Jesus, old man, get a grip. Brian, you are pathetic yourself. That's the only, I mean, I don't even know what to say, you know. No, you're pathetic. No, I'm pathetic. I mean, this is damn foolishness on his part. What I'm saying, Brian, let's remove me from the, I mean, think of the contemptuous. Old, am I old? Maybe I am getting to that point. I mean, I don't know. If, you know, if he's 18 or 19 or 22 or 23, I suppose I do look old. Selfish. Why am I selfish? Why am I a hippie? Childless? Hey, there's too many people in the world. I'm doing other people a favor. That I hate anyone who's achieved more success than I do. That's absolutely untrue. What I care about is a country that penalizes people for working hard, like the people at Borders, that can work their butts off. See, this is what he means, that I hate anybody who's achieved more success than I do. So this is what this character, that unless he's a wealthy guy himself, is usually probably a working class or a lower middle class guy himself who loves people in power. You know, hey, Mr. So-and-so, you know, like that. Yeah, I mean, I know this type like this. You know, they worship people of wealth and power, even though they're never going to get anywhere near it themselves. I don't know whether it's vicarious thrills or just what I always talk about. You know, they love top-down society and, you know, they despise anybody beneath them. He's saying I despise everyone above me. I don't despise these people at all. I mean, I've got pretty much dislike for people that send... or, you know, for rich guys that send ordinary men and women off to kill and be killed in Iraq when there's no need for it whatsoever. I dislike the political, economic, social equation that takes a wealthy world and condemns a billion people, at least, maybe more, a couple billion people, to lives of absolute misery when there's no need for it whatsoever. That condemns tens of millions of people to die from AIDS when there's no need for it. That charges our old people, whether you see me in that category or not, including your parents and your grandparents, to pay extraordinary sums, unnecessary sums for the medications that you have to take, much of it caused by the kind of pollution that Bush's friends pump out into our lungs and our food and our water and our air. And get away with it because Bush has been paid off in this auction called an election, right? Well, this is why I hate everyone who's achieved more success. And I hate people that, I don't hate the CEO of Borders because he makes $23 million a year and has paid millions of dollars to a union-busting firm to stop his employees from earning more than $20,000 a year. But, I mean, shouldn't you just be filled with utter revulsion and contempt about someone presiding over those processes against George Bush, against CEOs like this, against the 400 or 500 wealthy men in this world that keep billions in poverty and illness, that make people work all over the world for peanuts so we can have little toys and what have you? That the big corporations of this country employ people in Haiti and China and Nicaragua and places like that 10, 12, 15 hours a day that virtually keep them captive, that they would wish they lived in 19th century America and all the horrors of work that existed then, because their conditions are even worse than that. And that translates into millions and then billions for North Americans and Europeans. Man, if you don't hate that process, you're really an awful person. I don't hate you at all, but I just wonder how did you get so divorced, Brian, from humanity that you couldn't care about the ordinary person in this country or the person working for 17 cents an hour in Haiti sewing up your baseballs or something like that, and you love these wealthy characters that would spit on you if they even knew you even existed. Well, maybe you can call on that. But thank you for your email. Let me see, there was another couple of emails here. This is from Josh, who's 18 years old in Waterford. He says, I know this sounds bad, 18-year-old guy talking about the drinking age, but to me it doesn't sound right that someone can be drafted in the Army. Well, there's no draft anymore, but look out for it, Josh. It might be coming. There's not enough troops. And they can die for their country or be married, but cannot drink at their own wedding. I know this sounds like I just want to drink, but I think something should be changed. Hell, I can vote. I want to be able to vote drunk. I want to be able to vote drunk, then maybe we might get someone that doesn't have their head in their ass. Well, hey, people voted all right in 2000, Josh. They voted to defeat George W. Bush. The majority of people voted against George W. Bush. Of course, you have these right-wing wackos that he brings into government, like this guy. What's his name? Boykin. This General Boykin? I mean, Boykin, doesn't Boykin mean something else? Hey, you Boykin her? You know, I mean, but anyways, General Boykin says, you know, George W. Bush did not get the majority of votes in the 2000 election. And this is this far-right-wing evangelical that's, I don't know, supposed to be tracking down Osama bin Forgotten, you know? And so he says, so why is George W. Bush in the presidency? And I think maybe, you know, he's going to tell the truth. His daddy's friends illegally placed him in there, you know, the Supreme Court. And it was, and you know, the vote in Florida was a sham run by his brother and the head of the campaign in Florida, the Florida Secretary of State, Cruella, who excluded tens of thousands of African Americans. No, God put George W. Bush into the presidency. God is right. All right, let's move on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello there, Peter Reno.
What? All right. Huh?
Yes, you know, I was wondering here, you shouldn't pick on poor Rush. I mean, after all, wouldn't you like to have a presidential candidate discover you someday and say, boy, I'm going to make you a star?
Yeah, I guess so.
You know, that's what, you know, well, that's the American dream. You know, that's the way you come up from your bootstraps anymore.
Right.
But, you know, the things that I was wondering about this week, with all this war that's going on over there in Iraq, and our industries are faltering, who's making our equipment and our uniforms for our troops?
I think it is American firms, but who knows?
I mean, everybody's being laid off.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, where's our tanks? Where's our uniforms being made? Maybe in Mexico or China?
No, they're probably made here. But, you know, hey, wait a minute. I thought everybody is all celebrating because suddenly the economy is just doing wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, but where's the jobs?
Well, there are some. Actually, there was, like, let me see how many jobs. 126,000 jobs created in October. According to the New York Times today, the numbers could be very good news for Bush, whose record on jobs, one of the worst of any president in the last century. Not one of the worst, the absolute worst. I guess Hoover. Hoover, the Depression-era Republican, said it was one of his biggest obstacles to re-election. But what's happening? Here's the mayor of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick. He says, while you see jobs coming back, they're not coming back in the same sectors. What he means is, the industrial jobs, the well-paying union jobs, they're still fleeing the country, and what's coming back at us are service jobs paying $9.50 an hour at Borders, and that's why the Borders workers are on strike. So, you know, it's, again, figures don't lie, but liars can figure, right?
Maybe, but, you know, with all this steel that's being shipped to India, and the foundries are being, you know, the steel foundries are all going to India and Bangladesh, and our steel foundries are down here. I mean, they've been closed up, and it takes steel to make equipment, especially for wars.
Well, you might as well make it all over there. We can just all do service jobs. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Whoa. What happened to... Okay. Thank you. I thought Rick Fox had disappeared. Hey, we're moving, by the way. WRIF is moving, but it might not be... Actually, it might not be for a while, huh? But we're going to have computers. You're going to be replaced by a computer, Rick. No, he won't. He's our phone screener and producer of the show. And so he chose, you know, holds up how many fingers, which I've already forgotten how many fingers. Yeah, okay. But now we're going to have... Didn't we talk about that one night? I was going to... What they have? They have these computers. So Rick would say, so-and-so on line one, you know, Jim from Owasso is on the phone. Look out, he's really angry. But, you know, I'm going to ask him not to do that. What I'm going to do is we're going to get your, like, first name and the city. So I'll say, hey, this is, you know, Al from Lapeer. Because, you know, I've done talk shows before and they kind of warn you in advance, not a friendly person. Well, then I lose focus on the person coming up. And also, like, for instance, what they'll do on these computers, like Rick would type in the other room, he'd say, Al from Lapeer wants to talk about the Jessica Lynch program and how she says that the Pentagon misrepresented what she did. Well, so my brain already starts formulating answers, and I'm not giving 100% attention to the current call. So I, you know, as far as I'm concerned, just do it all wild card. So the only thing we're going to get is that poor Rick is not going to have to keep dancing around holding up, one figure. And it's hard to see because we got all these, the window through which he's showing me is kind of blocked. Anyway, let's move on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
All right, you were talking about how Bush wanted to send in those 48,000 more troops.
43, yeah.
43,000. I was watching, I'm sure like a lot of other Americans were, watching Donald Rumsfeld on TV the other day making his little speech. And a buddy of mine, I go to Eastern Michigan University, and a buddy of mine's in the National Guard. And there was that plane that was shot down the other day. I think it was about 4 or 5 days ago.
The helicopter, and we lost 16 troops. Yeah, badly wounded. Yeah.
His crew from Atlanta is the one that's taken over. He's only got about 9 months left on his contract with the guard.
Wow.
I'm telling you, he doesn't really like Bush very much right now, because about 30 seconds after Rumsfeld got off TV, he got a call, and this weekend he left for Camp Grayling up north.
Man.
And they're probably going to extend his contract by about 18 months and send him out to Iraq.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're insisting that this is, you know, just a very, very small percentage of the Iraqi people that they can quell this, but there doesn't seem to be any sign of it subsiding, does it?
Not at all. I mean, they're sending all these kids out there, and they're dying for a no-good reason for George W. Bush to keep these guys out there, and we're spending money that we honestly shouldn't be spending for things that we could be improving this country on.
You know, it's interesting. Let me, normally, like in the Vietnam War, the average age of the GI was like 19 years old. And now I look at some of the battle deaths, and you see, like I've seen them as high as 43 years old. And oftentimes they're men in their 30s and, you know, upper 20s. And it's because you got the guard in there. That's, taking some of the hits. And some of the people that are getting killed, they're like mechanics or cooks or, you know, what have you.
Guys that aren't even supposed to be there.
No, I mean certainly not not the fighting force. The other thing is, there's a total of 392 U.S. soldiers dead, 2,230 wounded, and don't any of those wounded ever die? I mean, that's very strange. You know, they don't get counted. You know, I mean, you got to believe some of them suffer wounds and then don't survive them. What a horrible situation. Damn.
We honestly don't know what's actually going on over there, and I think a lot of this stuff is kind of a cover-up for something, and Bush is just trying to cover his ass for a lot of things that we have no idea, and then he's sending these people in there. Why doesn't he grab a gun and go in there himself?
Well, the last time, I don't know if you've heard me mention it earlier, but there's this phrase called chicken hawks, and that means that all of these Republicans and all of these conservatives, they're real hawkish on war, yet they all scammed out of the Vietnam War. There's actually a whole website that lists all of the people in the Bush administration and all these conservative commentators and talk show hosts, and shows that they had this opportunity to be part of the fighting force during the 1960s and early 1970s, and all had the greatest excuses how they got out of it. Kind of sickening.
It is pretty sickening.
Thank you so much. I hope your friend and I hope everybody comes home safe and that we can end all this. Thank you.
I hope so. Thanks.
All right. Bye now. All right, we'll take a break and be right back to get your calls. Actually, open lines first time tonight, 313-298-WRIF, and here it comes again.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the RIF Cyber Crew. It's your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the RIF on-air giveaways.
Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air.
Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, this sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the RIF Cyber Crew today.
Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream. It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too.
To WRIF.com.
WRIF.com.
More Riff Rock is coming right up.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like La Scala, located in the heart of Windsor's famous Little Italy district, you can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's five best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save.
With the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We were talking with Peter Frampton about his TV viewing habits, including reality TV.
I could watch Peter Frampton's week edited into a half an hour. I'd watch it like crazy.
Oh, hell yeah.
Just in case you hit the voice box.
Yeah. So who's the other girl with the mess that's always falling out of her clothes?
Anna Nicole Smith, the big fat ass.
Yeah.
Who was always...
I did not say that, but...
Have you tapped that?
That was pretty unbelievable.
Now, if you had to guess, Peter, because you've been around the block, what is she on?
I'd say a combination of muscle relaxers, Ambien, and Percodan.
Very good. Wow.
Drew. That sounds good.
And Mike. Hey. In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's Riff.
101 WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
Riff.
You're listening to 101 WRIF Detroit, a greater media station broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. There's more Riff Rock coming right up, so don't go anywhere.
All day Thursday, your walk right in free station, 101 The Riff, unleashes a ticket blitz Thursday. Keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF all day this Thursday
for your chance to hook up with tickets to all of the hottest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Hooking you up like no other Detroit station can.
Listen for your chance to win. Then call a Riff request line at 313-298-WRIF.
Don't forget.
You can always improve your chances to win by joining the Riff Cyber Crew today and score your totally unfair internet advantage.
Just log on to WRIF.com.
It's Ticket Blitz Thursday on the Riff all day Thursday from your walk right in free station. 101 The Riff.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Mamma Mia's, located conveniently inside the Quality Suites in downtown Windsor. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roche, put your best face and body forward with help from Dr. Roche.
Log on today and save.
With the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Broadcasting worldwide on the web, you're listening to 101 WRIF at WRIF.com, a service of Greater Media. Keep it here for more Riff Rock coming right up.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed.
But do bird watching. There is like 10 times more bird watchers than hunters. You know, I don't know what that says, but a lot of these hunting advocates are pretty aggressive, and not all, you know, not all. I saw my neighbor, and a friend of mine and I were talking. The other neighbor says, "Get your deer," and he says, "Yeah, I got it." You know, and I mean, there's too many damn deer in the state for one thing. I mean, that's a whole long other thing. Here, though, this absolutely repellent statement. Now, you got to remember, Ted got kicked off a couple stations for making racist remarks when he was touring earlier this year. But he has the I don't know what you could call it, the unmitigated gall to say, I'm Rosa Parks with a 12-gauge. Rosa Parks with a 12-gauge, and I'm hunting doves next September. Well, Ted, you're not going to be doing it. Believe it. Governor Granholm will veto the bill. But that's not even it. I mean, we could argue forever about hunting doves and all that. To me, it's really repellent. These little birds, you know, blast them with a 12-gauge. I mean, anyway. But Rosa Parks, this ordinary, gentle person that changed the history of this country by refusing to submit to the racist humiliation of ever after having worked a hard day, was told to get to the back of the bus and give up her seat back in 1956, and she refused. And you know that whole history. And this rich creep from Jackson says that he compares himself to Rosa Parks. I mean, I'm having difficulty speaking with my lip curled in contempt and disgust. Ted, play your guitar. Yeah, you can do that great. This is from Paul. He says, I'm a listener from Boston, Massachusetts, and he's listening on WRIF.com. He said, I'd like to hear your opinion on this story, and he gives the link. That broke this week, the Pentagon has begun recruiting for local draft boards. Now, boy, yeah, Rick, you could be over there fighting in Syria or Iran or wherever, you know, Bush and these maniacs decide to start the next unnecessary war. Actually, they didn't have enough people for this one. Things are, you know, not going well in Afghanistan either. We just never hear about that particular one. In any event, Paul, sure, they want to be ready for all eventualities. They're certainly not going to do this before the election. And you could imagine how quickly support would erode for Bush and for any continued presence in Iraq. Right up to the run-up of the war. At one point, I mean, I guess the war had started, and 80% of college students said they supported the unnecessary invasion of Iraq. Well, I mean, I'm calling it unnecessary, the invasion of Iraq. And then they said, do you support a draft? 80% of them were opposed. So what they love are just the ordinary working class or poor man or woman, young man or woman, who gets forced into the armed services in kind of a poverty draft. Oh, yeah, I think that's very cool that you go over there and get your face shot off or your Humvee gets a roadside bomb or a rocket-propelled grenade or something like that. I'm cheering you on all the way. I'm going to be at the Veterans Day Parade. What? The Veterans Day Parade has been canceled because there's not enough troops here and there's not enough equipment? Well, I still support you. I support our troops. Oh, of course, I'd never become one because I have my college studies. Man. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, my name is Brian.
Hi, Brian.
Hi. I'm calling from Lincoln Park.
Hey, the home of the MC5.
Right. I just did a quick thing about, because I'm really into music, you know, that's like half my life or, you know, my life.
Yeah, all of us.
And, the music censorship, that's like my low point. I hate that for some, you know, because, I listen to the riff, you know, all the time, and, they block out, the cuss words, but, not after a certain time they don't.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, I don't get, I don't really get, why you can't say the F word at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but you can do it at 1 o'clock at night.
Well, because there are specific rules of, I don't remember exactly when the time is, but the Federal Communications Commission that presides over that kind of stuff, they don't want children to hear those rude words. I'm not sure what effect they think it will have on them or what they think of kids that are watching daytime television soap operas with people naked in bed and actually doing what the word connotes, or... I mean, it doesn't make a bit of sense, but I mean, things have loosened up, so incredibly. I mean, I'm kind of old school, as one of our creepy emailers was suggesting. So I can't even say, you know, you can say, I mean, I can't bring myself to say now. You can say I'm PO'd. You can say what that stands for. Now they even say that on mainstream television. You can. I mean, I hear Drew and Mike saying things in the morning. I'm going, man, I cannot believe that they're saying that. And I don't know. So things have come a long way. I mean, it used to be the 11 words that you couldn't say.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some of them you still can't. The S word, the F word, the C word. I don't think. Yeah. So but, yeah. What?
But it's like, you know, because you have to be like 17 to buy the, you know, the parental advisory whatever things.
Yeah.
The CDs. But like, I don't know, I just don't get it. I mean, because me, I mean, I'm 18,
uh-huh.
You know, I mean, so I can buy it no matter what. But, you know, I mean, I think it's pointless.
I agree with it is pointless, but every culture has things that are taboo. I mean, certain things you can't do. In Arabic culture, for instance, you know, some of these townspeople were angry at American soldiers flying over with their feet dangling out of the plane, so the soles of their feet showed down to the village, and that's like a real insult. You know, we sit around, we put our feet up on the table if mom or the wife isn't around, you know, something like that. And I mean, you do that when you've been invited into somebody in a traditional Muslim culture, you've really insulted them. And for instance, there's the famous case that the worst thing 50 years ago an English person could say was the adjective bloody. You'd say, well, I bloody well won't do this, or the bloody so-and-so, you know. And the people aren't even sure the origin of the word, but it was just awful. Somewhere, it's some classic rock, I can't think of the band, you're right, bloody well, right, serves you what, bloody well, right, to something or other. I can't even remember, but, so you know, so suddenly, you know, the word became acceptable. So pretty soon, because you hear the F word more and more frequently, I noticed, like, on the PBS special on the blues that they had, you know, that where they had taped interviews, and they had people saying the F word continually without it being censored. So we have that to look forward to. We can say the F word pretty soon. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Chris says, I'm 19. I've been listening to your show for a few years now. What got me first listening to you was a show you did on religion and spirituality. But since September 11th, you haven't talked about that at all. I tried to email you last week when you were talking about the show topics, but I guess it was too late. I did get it, and it was too late. It would be nice if once in a while you just digress from the war and the Bush administration. Just a thought. I remember somebody said I was doing overkill about the war in Iraq. All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. This is David from Warren.
Hi, David.
And I'm an I'm not an ex-hippie. I think once you were a person of the the hippie era, you'll always be a hippie at heart. But I'm old enough. Sometimes there's an advantage in being older, and that is that you remember the pain and the suffering that a country goes through when its youngest and finest are sent off to an immoral and needless war.
Yeah, and you're talking about the guy that said I was just an old hippie, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Charles Rangel in the U.S. Congress has proposed a reinstitution of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, you kind of stole my thunder a little bit, but I think that fellows like that guy that called in, some of these young guys that are so callous in their attitudes, I think they need a draft card, you know, and I think they need a lottery number, and I think that's when it starts to hit home.
Sure. Well, Charles Rangel and I think also John Conyers of Detroit were going to introduce that because they said, who's in the Army now? It was the same thing in Vietnam. It didn't, even though we had a draft, didn't change it that much. Were the poor and the working class, and disproportionately people of color, Hispanics that Rangel was concerned about as he represents them, and John Conyers, African-American. So what they were saying, hey, let's spread this out. Let's get the rich kids. Let's get the middle-class kids in equal at equal risk for losing their life or a limb or half their face or their leg or their intestines in Iraq, and see how quickly this all comes to a conclusion.
Yeah, and regarding the media, the only broadcast network, I know sometimes you're a little rough on National Public Radio, but I watch public television, and the Lehrer News Hour,
yeah.
They're the only people that really show the faces of these young people who have died during the week.
Really?
And that is really a poignant moment.
What do you mean, they show photographs?
They show photographs of these kids. And, you know, I think it really, it's just really a somber moment, and it's very poignant, very touching. And I think that the other networks should be doing the same thing. These kids are immune from what the realities of war are.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting. I was looking in the New York Times today, and they had an article about that helicopter that got shot down near Tikrit, and there was 16 people. And, you know, this all does, even with me, get into the arena of a political debate. And then I just looked at these people, and, you know, they're alive when you see this, you know, frozen moment that were, you know, photographs that was taken a month ago or a year ago or something like that. And I just kept looking at it. I said, these people are all dead now. I mean, it did have a dramatic impact on me.
Well, you were referring to those who are wounded and then later pass away. And I believe 15 were killed instantly, and the 16th died here just yesterday.
So they did count him. You're right.
Okay.
You're right.
And thanks for getting after Nugent. And, you know, I'm waiting now. Nugent said that if Jennifer Granholm won the governorship, that he was going to run against her. So bring it on, Ted.
Hey, by the way, you know, this guy that was lighting into me for being an old hippie, and I actually wasn't. You know, there was this film that they just showed at the Detroit Institute of Arts on the MC5?
Mm-hmm.
It was called MC5, A True Testimonial. And there I was. I had about a 2-second cameo, just some footage of me in front of the old Fifth Estate newspaper office. And I thought, damn, do I look straight? You know, I mean, just kind of regular hair, and I had kind of a short sleeve shirt on. And yeah, I never was into all that dashiki and, you know, hair. I mean, cool. I mean, I looked at guys like that that had shoulder length hair and long beards and stuff like that and beads and what have you. And I don't know why I never did it. I don't know. Maybe a little self-conscious. Who knows? All right. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks, Pete.
Yeah. What do we say? Keep the faith, brother. Keep the faith. Yeah. You should. You know, keep those ideals. I mean, everything about these conservatives, when that one guy said, the Loving Audubon Society, the NAACP, and he says, you know, you're just an old hippie. Like there's, you know, something, he's disparaging of people that grow older in this society. Well, what must he think of his parents or his grandparents or what? And a hippie. I mean, everything that was. I mean, think about what hippies were all about. They were about peace and love. Oh man, what a pack of fools, man! You know how terrible. I mean, what a bunch of jerks, huh? They, you know, what, you know that. Elvis Costello tune. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? And, you know, that's what the hippies embody, right? Peace, love, understanding. You know how much of the conservative brain can wrap around that? Zero. They're about anger. They're about contempt. They're about dismissing people. They're about, you know, discriminating against people. They're about loving wealth and power. No matter how much wealth and power hurts people, they're about worshiping it. All right, and you know, and they're very, you know, they're very engaged in seeking it. You know, so that's why they, even though they're, you know, they're such a minority in the world, they've been able to distort the societies we live in and the world that we live in. And some regard, it's our fault. I mean, the vast majority of the people in the world have let this small minority, this infinitesimal minority, this 1% or 2%, essentially control the economics and the politics and the social systems of the world. But then in every country, there's always this angry, vocal minority that supports them because of just twisted psychoanalytical reasons, that they're these worshipers of power and wealth, even though they're as divorced from power and wealth as all the rest of us. But go figure. I mean, you know, can't we get them to work out their psychological problems in some other way other than supporting those people that are ripping off the people of the world and ruining the world on every possible level? Well, well. Let's see. All right, here's another call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. Yes, another David.
Hi, David.
How you doing?
Half my friends are named David.
Good. I've got to disagree with you on a couple of points.
Sure.
The first thing I heard tonight that I disagreed with was it seemed like you were throwing the Republican Party into a separate cage of their own that is entirely backed by big industry and commercialization.
Yeah.
Don't you think the Democratic Party is backed by a large corporate?
Yeah, you know, it's not as much as it was. I mean, because the Democrats are starting, are kind of working their way into being a footnote of history. But, yeah, I mean, that the auction for elections involved the Democrats as well. But increasingly, the vast majority of corporate funding goes to the Republicans. But I don't want to let the Democrats off the hook. I mean, I wish
Absolutely not. They're all waist deep into it.
Yeah, I wish
the
insurance
companies and all those other industries that are just
sure
feeding money into them.
I mean,
for their own special interest.
I mean, everybody that you know says, "Oh, you know, your boy Clinton and Gore and all that." I'm going, "Wow, man, they must have not listened to this program during the '90s when I was continually critical of the
Clinton." Rip them off. You're going to rip out one party, man.
Yeah.
The other thing that you know, I mean, what do you do over in? You got to figure that the United States is 80% Christian.
Yeah.
And if we were to just back off of the Middle East and turn our backs on Israel, you know, the Christian belief is that if we back up Israel, God's going to back us up. And if we turn our backs on Israel, we're going to open ourselves up to even more terror. Israel would be no more.
Listen, a lot of what the mess, a good portion of the mess that's been created in the Middle East is a long-standing result of almost 100 years of colonial domination of the region, of this exploitation of the area by European colonialism, and then after World War II, the United States moving in again in an exploitative capacity. And, you know, it's a long-standing problem. So I mean, it's not like you can even solve it overnight. But the solution for the Middle East is pretty easy. George Bush ought to be impeached. All right, let's get real. But the United States ought to withdraw as a supervisory power. It all ought to be turned over to the United Nations. The United States, because it was an illegal and absolutely unnecessary war, ought to foot the bill to rebuild it. Now, that reduces the amount of money involved there considerably, because the majority, two-thirds of the money is for the military over there. The United Nations ought to step in. United States corporations ought to do the rebuilding. And their profits ought to be severely limited. They shouldn't be able to profit from this, you know, from the misery created and the death created that they're partly responsible for. And I think then you might get, people over there thinking, maybe the United States isn't as bad as we anticipated. They're not over here to dominate our region. They're not over here to steal our oil. All right, got to go. Thank you, David. Do we have time for one quick call more? All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
How you doing, Peter? My name is Ted.
Hi.
I've been actually motivated to call you, and just haven't really had a good subject until tonight. I was listening to 60 Minutes. I'm sorry to drop the name.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's okay.
Arafat and how they had, you know, Yasser Arafat and how he was, like, bilking the United States for money, claiming his country is broke. And they had discovered where he put the money and how we got all wrapped up into this. I mean, the whole Middle East thing and our United States is just one big, big messy ball. And they just, like, we've been, like, supporting that country and the whole regime over there, the Palestine, the Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq. I just think they have no integrity. All those countries are just playing us for fools.
Well, we have one as the head of this government. I think that's where the real problem lies. All right, I got to actually end this segment of the show, so I want to thank you for being our last caller. I appreciate it. And thanks to all of you that are listening online. Paul from Bowling Green had a good story, no time to tell it, about the drug war in a small-town high school where he graduated from, where that they had one of those... So they would close all the classroom doors, cover the windows, and tell the teachers not to let anyone leave the room. During the 4 years I attended, the only thing they found were a bag of dog food and a package of Oreos, both during the same search. Yeah, it's a war against the American people. Thank you so much. Let's do this again next week. It seems to work pretty well.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Ladies, do guys crowd the windows at the gym just to see you during aerobics class? Have you noticed that the jogging trail by your house now has bleacher seating? Then you need to get to the Pantheon Club this Thursday night for the Best Breasts in the Midwest contest. This contest is not all about size. It's about what you've got and what you're willing to do with it to win your share of $1,500. That's $1,000 for first place. Guys, the best part is that you get to be the judges. All contestants must be in the door by 10 p.m. That's the Best Breasts in the Midwest this Thursday at the Pantheon Club. And now on Sundays, join them for Bladder Buster Night. Yep, that's right. Starting at 7 p.m., draft beer is only 50 cents until somebody goes to the bathroom. Think you can hold it? After that, all draft beer goes to $3.75. It's Bladder Buster Nights on Sundays starting at 7 p.m. with 50 cent drafts until, well, that's up to you. Also on Sundays, join them for Sunday Night Football with $3.75 draft beer until the game ends. Watch the game on 3 42-inch plasma TVs, and they roll out another 3 60-inch flat screen TVs to the floor. And you get a free drink when the team you pick scores a touchdown. And don't forget, there's always topless women, too. Now the Pantheon plays 95% rock and roll. If you hear it on the Riff, you'll hear it at the Pantheon. The Pantheon, a different kind of topless bar.
Dr. Tafor and the Windsor Laser Eye Institute. More experience, more options, more value.
More experience.
Did you know that Dr. Tafor at Windsor Laser Eye Institute has performed well over 30,000 LASIK procedures? Or that he was the first in North America to perform LASIK over a decade ago?
More options.
Now, Dr. Tafor is the first to offer custom cornea wavefront LASIK, an advanced system light years beyond conventional LASIK, so that you can enjoy a future free from glasses or contacts. Now, more than ever, Dr. Tafor can customize treatment specific to you, ensuring the best possible results and safety.
More value.
With the most experienced personalized treatment and state-of-the-art technology, why would you trust your eyes to anybody else? Hey, this is the doc from the Riff. I had mine done by Dr. Tafor. Why not you? Call 1-800-663-IC for a free one-on-one consultation with Dr. Tafor. Call him at 1-800-663-IC. And be sure to ask about their 0% financing. The Windsor Laser Eye Institute. More experience, more options, more value.
Hey, Napoleon, where are you going?
I'm going to Waterloo to meet my enemies.
But you could get defeated if you go there.
Who cares? It's over for me anyway. My wife, Josephine, she's divorcing me. She has this tough lawyer who wants to take everything. My palace at Versailles, all the fancy medals I win.
Oh?
Even my faithful horse, Pierre.
Well, there's no reason for a man to lose his home, his children, his money, or his self-respect.
Oh?
Now, Adam is here to protect you. Adam is the American Divorce Association for Men.
Ah.
They're a group of highly qualified divorce attorneys and counselors who will defend the rights of men in any divorce case.
Ooh.
Adam will answer your questions about divorce at no charge. Call the American Divorce Association for Men.
Hello, this is Napoleon the Great speaking.
Who is that, you nappy dally?
Josephine, what do you want from me now?
Adam is handling your divorce.
Yes, so?
Well, maybe after you conquer the rest of Europe, we could have lunch. I mean, it's nothing to lose your head over.
Call Adam at 248-356-ADAM. That's 248-356-ADAM.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werbe,
on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Good morning, and thank you very much for joining me. Those of you who have listened to this broadcast over the months, over the years, gee, I think it might even be over the decades, but we try to have a vision of what is possible. We look at today's contemporary society, identify problems, and figure out solutions. Sometimes the solutions are so complex that we're really stuck at a level of only identifying the problem. I think that's a good way to begin. Then, of course, we have to go into solutions. And I have a book that was sent to me. It looks at both the problem and offers solutions and talks about solutions for our country and also some suggestions of solutions from around the world. The book is called Natural Assets, Democratizing Environmental Ownership. Now, when I first saw that title, it didn't really click in what it was all about, but let me say it again. Natural Assets, Democratizing Environmental Ownership. It's edited by James K. Boyce and Barry G. Shelley, and normally we have one of the editors, but I thought there was an aspect of this that was pretty compelling, and I'd like to welcome Raquel Penderhughes. And Raquel Penderhughes lives in the Oakland, Oakland, California area, and she's contributed a piece, an essay to this book, Poverty and the Environment, the Urban Agriculture Connection. Raquel Penderhughes, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you today.
I was sort of stumbling over Oakland, California, because we have Oakland County. In fact, that's where I'm broadcasting from. Tell us a little about the book, and maybe in general, to make clear what this means, Natural Assets, Democratizing Environmental Ownership.
Right. Let's begin with the term natural assets, which is very unfamiliar to most people. It's a very new term. The term essentially refers to all the natural resources on which humans depend, and that would include the land on which we live and grow our food, the water we drink and use to irrigate our crops and generate electricity, the air that we breathe and into which we also emit pollutants, the fish and aquatic life in the ocean, the trees in the forest, and the animals and the plants. It would even include the atmosphere, ores, minerals, fossil fuels beneath the Earth's surface, solar energy, basically all those natural resources on which we depend. The asset-building approach basically focuses on the capacity of access to natural resources to alleviate poverty and move forward the goal of social equality.
Now, that's why, for instance, I was going to bring this up. We're not just talking about the environmental movement, which tries to fix the pollution of our soil and our air and our water, but this has another word attached to it, the environmental justice movement. So that brings into play a whole different quality of issues.
Right. The issue here and the focus of the book is based on the fact that low-income communities suffer from a lack of access or control over natural resources, and more importantly, that low-income communities and low-income people are the victims most frequently of environmental contaminants and toxins. And so the question is, how do we both alleviate poverty, major social problem in the United States and around the world, and how do we also reduce the environmental injustices that people are facing as a consequence of industrial processes and production and consumption?
Mm-hmm. Now,
how do we... Go ahead. Just how do we move forward the goal of poverty reduction, which is the goal that pretty much everyone in the world shares, and environmental protection, another goal that is very popular and increasingly more important around the world.
Now, I've only landed in Oakland, California. I've never visited your city, but from my understanding, they have some very similar definitions, that there's a lot of poverty, a lot of people with a lot of spirit, and but a lot of problems to address. And your chapter, Raquel Penderhughes, in the book Natural Assets, which is published by Island Press, Poverty and the Environment, the Urban Agricultural Connection, one would think on the face of it, though, any kind of agriculture and where people have the ability to produce their own food is good in and of itself. The larger issue of distribution of wealth in the world, the poverty, and, you know, in the midst of great affluence, I mean, how is that even touched by urban agriculture?
Right. Now, of course, we have to talk about this question in a U.S. context and a non-U.S. or non-industrialized nation context. But let's just talk about it in the U.S. to begin with, where we do have a large number of people living in poverty, about 10% of the population. I'm arguing in my book that urban agriculture has multiple benefits, both environmentally and socially. In terms of the social benefits for low-income people, It can alleviate hunger and malnutrition. It can improve public health very directly by providing people with access to fresh foods and lowering the amount of money that they have to spend on foods that they purchase. It can contribute to individuals being provided with alternative sources of income if they choose to sell a portion of that food, and there are some communities in the United States that are able to do that. There are many job training programs that are associated with urban agriculture and the sale of food to urban consumers. And urban agriculture also supports community participation. In addition, it is a way of improving abandoned lots and reducing urban blight in communities. So not even looking at the environmental impacts, which are multiple as well, there are many social benefits that are associated with getting people into the opportunities of being able to grow food.
Now, when I think of urban agriculture, and this might be my myopia, is I usually think of it as a middle-class phenomena, and mostly done for aesthetic reasons. People want better quality food, and they just like gardening. And maybe in answering, maybe you could expand on the idea of community participation, because having what they have in cities like Montreal and what have you, large communal gardens that brings everybody together. So it, two questions. One, like I see it, as I said, is it strictly a strictly speaking a middle class phenomena? And secondly, a little more about community.
Right. Those are both great questions. It's true that in the United States, when most people think about gardening, they think about backyard gardening for pleasure, and that's frequently associated in our minds with plant growing, you know, beautiful plants. But the reality is, we have a long history in the United States, especially following World War II, of people actually using their gardens for purposes that have to do with growing food and also providing food to a larger community.
Oh, yeah, Victory Gardens.
That's right.
Yeah.
Victory Gardens, which were very much a part of both the Western European and U.S. experience, were gardens in which people grew food to send either to people in their communities who were increasingly poor because they had been their soldiers had been sent abroad and families were now receiving less income, and or in some cases actually sending food to soldiers abroad. So we do have a long history here of programs that were built on the Victory Garden experience, which were designed to get people to grow food specifically to eat and, more importantly, to provide to other uses, including charitable organizations like food, homeless shelters, and the like. With regard to the second question about, well, maybe I should say, outside of the United States, urban agriculture plays a much more fundamental role where people who are much more poor and are really just eking out a survival-level existence,
but you are
very dependent upon growing food.
You are agreeing with me. I'm sorry. I don't mean to keep cutting you off. You agree, though, that this in the United, I mean, I'm talking about even neighborhood or communal gardens. City gardens tend to be generally middle class. I guess what I was looking for was is it present in more working class and even more importantly in poor neighborhoods?
Right. And so that's, I think, where the term urban gardening is an interesting and useful term. Because if we think of gardening as that which you do privately in your own backyard, which we associate mostly with home ownership because of the need to have a backyard, then gardening might be something that is mostly done in middle and working class communities. But if we use the term urban gardening to refer to a phenomenon that's pretty different, we're talking about people who are gardening outside of their own homesteads. That is to say, they are using public land which has either been abandoned or which has been allocated to them for that purpose to grow food in a more communal sense. In that instance, when people are growing outside of their own homes in public space, that is much more associated with people of lower income. Although there are in some communities many members of the middle class who are also participating in that because it's a pleasurable social activity.
Mm-hmm.
But there are increasingly throughout the United States in lower-income communities all over the country, plots of public land that have been allocated or taken because they were abandoned and degraded and used by communities to grow food, mostly in lower-income communities. And I use the example in my book of New York City, which in the 1970s had underwent an experience that's very characteristic of this, which was when neighbors began to clean out vacant lots in lower-income communities, basically transitioning sites that were being used for drug dealing and other activities that were not productive, cleaning them up, beautifying them, and using them to grow food and also beautiful plants. And that is more characteristic of what we mean by urban gardening, when lower-income residents in lower-income communities, although although there are some exceptions in middle-income communities as well, take over public spaces or are allocated public spaces, and in community, that is to say, with many people participating outside of their own private homes, are growing food and plants. And that's quite different than what you are referring to as the sort of more middle-class, enjoyable
sure.
luxury activity of growing plants in your own home.
My guest is Raquel Penderhughes. Sorry. Raquel Penderhughes is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show, and she's authored Poverty and the Environment, the Urban Agricultural Agriculture Connection, and it's an essay on natural assets, democratizing environmental ownership. And I'm looking through the book, and I don't see any biography. I wonder if you could tell me how you connect with all this and how you're involved in promoting urban agriculture.
Yes. Well, I'm a professor at San Francisco State University, and I teach in the Urban Studies and Environmental Studies program. And most of my work and most of my career has been spent documenting the disproportionate impacts of pollutants and toxins in lower-income communities. But in the later stages of my career, about a decade ago, I became very interested in understanding some of the solutions as well as the problems, pretty much building on what you started, how you started off the program. We know a lot about the problems. We know less need to know more about the solutions. How do we deal with the problems related to urban poverty in the United States and around the world? And I began looking for opportunities to think about how not only lower-income communities, but within the world and the United States more generally, we could, in fact, address some of the very serious environmental and social problems that we face. And I became very interested in looking at a whole range of opportunities that fall within the category of what we call sustainable development. And that would include opportunities for cleaning up cities and managing natural resources in the area of waste and water and energy and transportation and, of course, food. And urban agriculture, because it has so many obvious and immediate environmental and social benefits, became of great interest to me, and I've spent a long time traveling around the world documenting and trying to understand how you can move forward.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the RIF Cyber Group. It's your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the RIF on-air giveaways.
Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air.
Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, that sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the RIF Cyber Crew today.
Going on, and we just let people kind of do their own thing. But there are other parts of the world in which urban authorities are actually providing people with land more formally and more generally, and also providing them with other kind of supports for actually growing food.
I know that in some cities, I mean, I'm trying to think of the ones I was at, maybe Chicago, maybe Montreal, where the city authorities actually provide the tools for horticulture.
Yes, there are some cities, there are many communities in Philadelphia, there are cities in New York City, Northern California, in Berkeley, California, and San Francisco. There are many communities and many urban authorities around the United States that are increasingly understanding that helping people to figure out ways in which to move forward the goals of ecological restoration and also to alleviate poverty are a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's especially true where competition for land is not so profound and where there are vacant lots. And a colleague of mine has documented in cities across the country, and he has a chapter in this book as well, Greg Watson, how many vacant lots there are, in fact, in most cities around the country.
Detroit.
That is to say, how many spaces are, in fact, available right now for people to transition from something ugly to something beautiful.
Detroit is almost ready for farming again.
I'm sure it is.
I mean, if you think about it, we had housing for over 2 million people.
Yeah.
We now have about 900,000.
Right.
So that there's, I'm not just talking about gardens. I'm talking about that we could do the kind of farms that that typified the city in its origins 250 years ago or so. You know, I'm really hesitant to say this because coming from a position of privilege that I have in this society, to make pronouncements about the poor oftentimes sounds insensitive. But we know because of the way this world is structured economically into classes and sometimes even into castes, that is a daunting a problem. Ultimately, at some level, I mean, someone like myself in the middle class isn't going to willing to accept this. But essentially, what we need to live is shelter, heating it if in a climate like Detroit, food and culture. I mean, there's many people throughout the world, particularly the more temperate climates, that that's all they have, and actually they have a very rich life. It's only when they're brought into the world of commodities, when you know, you don't have $150 gym shoes and every PlayStation and, you know, and 4 foot wide televisions, do you start having this desire for you know, I have none of those, by the way. But one, you know, the effects of poverty generally are on one's health. And many times on one's sense of self-worth. I don't know, that was kind of a long-ranging statement, but I just saw these figures that said that that hunger in America, risk of families at risk from hunger, and actually people that have skipped meals, has grown tremendously in the last couple of 3 years.
Right. And I would add...
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to add to that, that not only are people increasingly more hungry in the United States, wealthiest country in the world, but people are increasingly suffering from the illnesses that are associated with diet. So we have increasing rates of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, various cancers. Obesity is a huge problem amongst young people. I think I read the other day that 60% of all American kids are obese. I mean, that's a ridiculously problematic figure. So I think what's important to understand about urban agriculture is that in and of itself, growing food in cities and in low-income communities particularly is not being proposed as a poverty elimination strategy. It's not going to do that. You have to get people work in meaningful jobs at living wages. But what urban gardens can do is they can provide lower-income communities and communities that are not of lower income with multiple ecological and social benefits. And those benefits are so profound, and they've been documented so thoroughly, that it really makes sense to figure out ways in which urban authorities can support these activities more, especially because people really like to do this.
Mm-hmm.
People like to grow food. They like to get their hands in the earth. They like to see things grow before them. They enjoy the taste of fresh food. And, of course, when people have an opportunity, they enjoy working together to make their neighborhood a more beautiful and enjoyable place to live. And in lower-income communities, of course, that becomes even more important. And that's, you know, in my article, I'm recommending urban agriculture as a or urban gardening, as I'm talking about it there, as an asset that can be used in cities to move forward both ecological and social benefits and to deal with environmental and social problems that are so profound in cities all over the world.
Raquel Pinder-Hughes, you've said that you've, and as you just said, that you've been around the world and seen some of this in action. Can you give us some examples, and particularly ones that could act as models for cities like Oakland, California, where you are, and Detroit, Michigan, where I am?
Yeah, there are actually models all over the world. I was just looking at some figures. Poland just celebrated 100 years of urban allotment food production. And if we think about Bulgaria's largest city, I mean, Sofia, which is the largest city in Bulgaria, it's home to about 15% of Bulgaria's population. In that city, urban agriculture has been an essential part of people's lives for centuries. And it's typical in all cities, including all the major cities, where people produce food in privately owned gardens and in backyards. About 50% of people in that city grow food, and about 90% of them make preserves and pickles, which they are able to either eat during the year or sell. There are many other examples. In Latin America, there's an organization called the Urban Agricultural Research Network, which goes throughout the countries in Latin America and provides people with allocation to land, allocation to extension agents who teach people how to grow food in a small scale, which is what's necessary in a city. In the country of Cuba, in the city of Havana, which is probably the best example of state-supported urban agriculture, you actually have whole departments that are and places that are dedicated to providing people with seeds and starts and natural pesticide alleviations and all sorts of other kinds of inputs that farmers need. So there's examples in every other part of the world. In Asia, there are many examples. The Chinese are famous for allocating land for intensive urban cropping systems and aquaculture. I mean, there are hundreds mm-hmm. of examples all over the world. I don't know if you can use them necessarily in the United States because our country is organized so very differently and private property is so much more widespread. But I think in the United States there are examples. In the city of Berkeley, we have the city of Berkeley renting for $1 a year a large tract of land organization that does job training and educational work with lower-income youth in the city. and kids are paid about $6 an hour, and they're trained not only to grow food, but also to do a lot of work in terms of the businesses associated with the selling of that food. And those young people then graduate with business skills that they can hopefully take on
now
to work in small businesses.
Now, you've mentioned other cities, and what is this possible to discern? Well, I mean, the self-conception that people have of what they're doing. In other words, when people here, like the middle-class people that I've seen, they're very self-aware. They're doing something that's, I think, one of the emails you sent or your publicist sent, he said, that, you know, that it's almost quaint. I mean, because they could just go to a market. They go to the best market in town and get the food that they need. They want to do this because they like gardening. They may like the experience of doing it with other people. Sometimes, like people here in Detroit, I know, that have put together five or six backyards and grow you know, considerable amount of urban agriculture. It's very, you know, they're very self-aware that they're doing this in the manner that you've been speaking. What is there a self-conception that people have of these long traditions in other countries?
Yes. I think in the United States we are much more out of touch with that history. In other words, Victory Gardens are sort of a very distant memory. But in most parts of the world, including in Western Europe and Australia and New Zealand, people are very connected to the traditional ways in which people have grown food and to the traditional activity that urban agriculture represents. But even here, I think people are somewhat connected, you know, especially as we have increasing number of immigrants to the United States, people are increasingly connected to their rural ways of life that they now are far distant from, but able to reproduce in some cultural sense through gardening in the cities in which they're locating. So I think you're right. In the United States, it's probably a very distant memory for many Americans, but there are also many people who have traditionally been attached to farming in their countries of origin or families as they moved from rural to urban areas. And I think people are somewhat connected to the historical importance for human beings and for modern people generally.
Now, one of the things I'd like to see, we talked about community and the effect that growing gardens in individual plots in, a large tract of land. We've got to get back to these old spring planting festivals and fall harvest festivals. And get the days off. We don't have enough festivals. And Americans, you know, the Marxists used to have a slogan, workers of the world unite. Mine is workers of the world relax. So we need more time off. And I know that back into, you know, and sometimes even in ancient history, there'd be these large festivals at the time of planting, you know, in spring, planting renewal and what have you. And then, of course, when the bounty arrives in the fall, a big celebration as well. Does that ever occur around any urban agriculture?
It does. I just want to say a couple of things. Of course, May Day was a harvest festival, and we certainly associate it with a workers' day in many parts of the world. And also Halloween, which just passed, was also a harvest festival and representation of summer plants dying and moving into the winter and the colder crops. So there are. I know that in Northern California we have something called a hose down, hose spelling H-O-E-S and representing the hoe used in gardening.
we use it differently here in Detroit. But
yeah,
go ahead.
We use it differently here too as well. But in this case it's an agricultural reference to the H-O-E hoe, which we use to turn the land. And the hose down, which is put on by a number of small organic farmers in Northern California area who provide food to the local farmers markets, is an opportunity for people to come together, farmers and non-farmers, to celebrate the great bounty of summer and also to honor, you know, cultivation as a long-standing human and traditional activity. So I'm not sure what's happening in other parts of the country, but there are May Day festivals and there are hose downs and there are increasingly in individual gardens people who come together to celebrate the end of one season and the beginning of another. And what does happen in a lot of community gardens is because you are beautifying spaces, these spaces become used for lots of different communal activities, of which getting together to celebrate one event or another is an important example.
Or, Raquel, people won't stay at home and watch television all by themselves.
Yeah. Well, they can watch gardening programs and then
there they go.
Or they can see what you learn, or food cooking programs.
I think even better, they should just go into the garden and watch the plants grow.
Yeah. Well, you know, you were talking about the importance of relaxation, and relaxation and stress reduction, I mean, there's no question there have been, you know, studies since the 1940s and 50s which have talked about the really important role that gardening can play in stress reduction. And from that perspective, more and more Americans need to get involved in it because we do know how high our stress is here.
Well, one final question because we're almost out of time. And that is, one of the things I don't think anyone really looks at, and unless you're going to a farmer's market, local farmer's market here in the Detroit area, you can go into a supermarket and even at harvest time, even like in August or early September, and never buy a single vegetable that was grown here in the, you know, the Michigan, Ontario, Ohio region. And the centralization of food production and distribution into this amazingly complex network, it has, you know, like all complex networks, has the possibility of failure. And one of the things that is good about local agriculture is that that worry is overcome.
Right. Local agriculture has many different benefits. From a health perspective, its immediate benefit is this, is that the food is more fresh and more nutritious. Also, when food is grown at small scale, it tends to be lower in pesticide use and synthetic fertilizers, so it has that health benefit as well. In addition, of course, when food is grown closer to people's residences, you use less fuel and you put more pollutants into the air as a result of combustion. I mean, we could talk for hours about the immediate environmental and social benefits of buying food locally. Now, in a place like Michigan, it's harder to do that all year, but it's certainly not hard to do that 4 or 5 months out of the year when people, in fact, are growing food at a small scale, and it is made available in places like farmers markets and sometimes also in supermarkets.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you being with me. And Raquel Pender-Hughes has the essay Poverty and the Environment, the Urban Agriculture Connection, and it's one of many essays in Natural Assets, Democratizing Environmental Ownership, and it's published by Island Press. You can go to islandpress.org. And Raquel Pender-Hughes, thanks so much for spending the time with me.
Thank you, and I hope everyone goes out there and puts their hands in the earth and grows food.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the Riff Cyber Crew. It's your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the Riff on-air giveaways.
Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air.
Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, this sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the Riff Cyber Crew today.
Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream. It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too.
WRIF.com.
More Riff Rock is coming right up.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants, like Amigos and Taylor in Woodhaven.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's 5 best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Your log on at WRIF.com. We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talk with rock and roll tennis pro Luke Jensen. It wasn't long before we all start talking about his brother Murphy.
What's up with your brother? Just because he knocks up Robin Givens doesn't know it means. Oh,
it's blow, man.
That was actually a cheap shot, and I'll apologize for it. Murphy did impregnate Robin Givens. That is true. Luke's
beautiful baby boy, 3 years old.
And is she now your sister-in-law?
She is. No, they are not married.
Are they together?
No, they're not together.
Ooh. Oh. Yeah. Was it even close?
No. Not even close.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
I hear you.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101
WRIF. Ow, you're shouting at me.
Riff.
Twice.
Is nice.
Tuesday
on the Riff.
Everyone, listen up.
Every Tuesday, 101 WRIF.
The home of
Rock and Roll
brings you Tuber Tuesday.
Keep it locked on the Riff all day this Tuesday for back-to-back badass blasts of your favorite Riff Rock band.
Plus, the Riff gives you the hottest tickets to the coolest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Who's your boy?
Tuber Tuesday.
Double the Riff Rock.
Double the Riff prizes.
Learn it. Know it. Live it.
Tuber Tuesday on the Riff. From 101 WRIF.
If it really rocks.
Well, begin transmission.
Here comes the music.
It's a riff.
We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment. This is 101 WRIF, broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. Thanks for listening.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants, like Antonio's Cucina Italiana, with three locations in Farmington Hills, Dearborn Heights, and Dearborn.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Yes, I do know that the subject of the legalization of marijuana comes up frequently, almost to the point where talk show hosts think, oh, I don't want to talk about that anymore. But this is an issue that I think greatly affects the American people, not just those perhaps 100 million people that are living today that have smoked marijuana or the people that continue, but our society as a whole. They talk about a war on drugs. Well, we have a war against Iraq, and we know how much that costs us and who is the pointed target of all that. But the war on drugs, the target is a large section of the American people. Let's talk about the implications of that. Joining me is Chrissy Eklund, and she is the Assistant Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project. Chrissy Eklund, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Tell me about your group. What differentiates the Marijuana Policy Project, say, from the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws or the number of other groups that are doing good work to try to bring about some sensible drug policy reform?
Well, I think we all have similar goals. We just work on different individual projects. Some of the things that we work on are lobbying at the state and federal level to change marijuana laws, specifically medical marijuana. We just had a partial victory in Maryland where Governor Ehrlich, he's the first Republican governor to sign a medical marijuana law, reduces the penalties for patients who use marijuana in Maryland, though they still would face a small fine if they're found guilty in court. But that's the sort of thing that we work on. We lobby in Congress to keep a check on the drug czar and try to get bills introduced that would respect states' rights to pass medical marijuana bills and to try to keep the DEA from overstepping their boundaries and putting a priority on raiding medical marijuana patients, which they've been doing.
What is the basis of the issue for maybe both yourself and also your organization? I mean, there's so many things that we could connect with. What's powerful about this issue for you and your organization?
There's so many things wrong with our marijuana laws. They're so unfair on so many levels. Someone at our organization once said, if there has to be a war on drugs, can we at least remove the sick and wounded from the battlefield?
Huh.
And that's why we focus a lot on medical marijuana. People think that it's a camel's nose under the tent. We're trying to legalize everything, and we're trying to make sure that little kids get marijuana, and that's not at all the reasoning. It's not because we think people should smoke marijuana at all. We don't encourage anyone to smoke it. We just think that if you do, you shouldn't go to jail, particularly if you use it medically.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the war on drugs, which I've been usually saying is a war on the American people. What is the toll? Start off financially, maybe just within, say, well, whatever you have figures for, the last 10, 20, 30 years. How much money has the American taxpayer funded this war on drugs to the tune of?
Well, Well, it's hard to put a specific number on it. What I can give you, for example, the DEA budget this year, 2003, is $1.9 billion, which may seem like a lot. And then you think about what the Drug Czar's office, that's the Office of National Drug Control Policy, he's a cabinet member appointed by the president, well, you know, confirmed by the Senate, but their budget is $19.2 billion for this year.
Hmm.
So right there is a little over $20 billion you know, officially spent by the DEA and the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Obviously, they work on other drugs as well, so it's hard to break that down into what's spent on, you know, the war on marijuana, but the war on marijuana is the bulk of the war on drugs. If they weren't going after marijuana, that those numbers would be much reduced.
And then, of course, you have all the local and state, county, municipal efforts as well.
Yeah, and that's a number I don't even have an estimate for you, because it's just nearly impossible to come up with a number. Another example of why it's difficult is to compute it is that the federal government, at least, they cook the books. The Drug Czar's office likes to point to the fact that they're spending, I don't know if it's one-third or one-half, something along those lines, on demand reduction and treatment. While to figure out that number, they've included alcohol treatment, which is not in their charter. They're not supposed to deal with alcohol at all. But when they lump in the money the federal government spends on that, it makes them look like they're spending more of their money on drug treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So they cook the books, and it's very hard to tell you know, what they're spending. And they also don't include the cost of prosecuting people in that budget.
Police time spent.
Yeah, they don't include that because they say that's a consequence of the laws, not a cost of... I don't even know how they justify it, quite frankly.
Well, you know, I've heard people say that if you would total up the amount of money spent on the war on drugs in the last generation, since, say, 1970, that we could have financed a national health program, we could have perfect schools rather than ones that are closing now, we could have an infrastructure with roads and everything that that would be, you know, the envy of the world, and instead we've essentially frittered away our money on a war that that I don't even think anyone believes can be won.
Yeah, it's just such vast quantities of money. I mean, there's somebody computed that the DEA and the Drug Czar's office spend more than three other departments combined. One is Health and Human Services, I think Department of Education, and another one. It's something, you know, ridiculous. They're spending more than that on a war that, you know, increasingly people are saying you can't buy your way out of this. It's just impossible. The cost, the cost-benefit analysis just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And the harm, when you talk about harm reduction, the harm is that the users of marijuana become intoxicated.
Right. They would also say, I mean, if you were asking someone in the Drug Czar's office, they would say, well, the harm comes to society because we have to pay to treat these people and to arrest them when they commit crimes, and, you know, people will get high and they'll run over little girls at the fast food drive-thru. That's one of the commercials the Drug Czar runs.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, just all sorts of things like that. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, alcohol is legal for people over 21. And people still drive drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, allowing it doesn't mean people won't still abuse it. I mean, people abuse it now. People abuse it if it's legal or illegal. It's an unfortunate fact of life. So, I mean, you're spending all this money to arrest people when it really doesn't solve the problem.
Detroiter John Sinclair once said, people are being arrested for smoking flowers.
Yeah.
Essentially. Well, and also there's an estimate that on a typical Saturday night, 20 million Americans are driving over the legal limit of for alcohol consumption.
Mm.
So, I mean, this seems to me, if we wanted, I mean, there are certainly are groups addressing that. One shouldn't take the worst case scenario for use of any product and dictate its social policy on the basis of that.
Right. I mean, you know, driving under the influence of anything that affects your driving negatively, that's never good. I mean, we don't want more people to drive under the influence of marijuana or alcohol or you know, anything, Benadryl. I mean, I can't drive if I take Benadryl. I will fall asleep at the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't get arrested for taking Benadryl. So, you know, it's let's get at the problem, which is driving intoxicated, not necessarily. I mean, it's a dicey issue because it depends on state laws and how they're worded and, you know, intoxicated mm-hmm. driving, or is it driving under the influence of alcohol or marijuana, or I mean, it's very complicated. It depends on state law. It's hard to just make a declaration saying that it shouldn't be that you shouldn't.
Well, the laws
are illegal
to
necessarily drive under the influence
right.
of marijuana.
The laws
should be illegal to drive under the influence of something that makes you drive badly.
The laws are there and they are in place. My guest, Chrissy, say your last name. Is it Eklund or Exlund?
Eklund.
Eklund, okay. Chrissy Eklund is my guest, and she is the Assistant Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project in Washington, D.C. And you have this sheet called Marijuana Prohibition Facts 2003, and most of them are absolutely astounding because the idea is that that people that smoke marijuana are doing harm to themselves and maybe tangentially harm to, you know, people in the community or their family, although it's a little difficult to really show what concrete harm there is. And yet, well, that's what you were saying. There's the cost-benefit analysis just isn't there. I mean, if you allowed people to smoke marijuana, and we already have a phenomenon of up towards 100 million people alive today who have smoked it, and it's a little hard to see where the damage to these individuals or society has taken place.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, you could say that the harm that comes to society is because of the laws against marijuana. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's marijuana is, we don't think everyone should go out and smoke it at all, but the laws against it are even worse. You know, putting someone in jail because they had a joint, I think that's worse than whatever harm could come from smoking that joint. I mean, that's totally disproportionate.
Well, tell us, I always like, although people sometimes say they get lost in a blizzard of figures, but some of these percentages that you have on this marijuana prohibition fact sheet mm-hmm. about how overwhelmingly Americans don't believe that marijuana smokers should be jailed.
Yeah, there was a Zogby poll came out very recently, and I think it was 41 or 42%. It's an all-time high. 41 or 42% of Americans don't believe people should go to jail for using marijuana.
This one says 72%.
Well, it depends on the survey and how it was worded. You know, when you talk about people shouldn't be put in jail, that's more support than if you use the word legalized.
Oh, okay.
People have a different idea of what that means. Well, everyone has a different idea of what that means. So if you use the L word, as I call it, support drops, even though there's no definition of that. So people just are scared by it.
Mm-hmm. Now, our neighbors to the north, Canada, have recently created a situation that has Washington with its shorts in an uproar. I guess Washington these days always has its shorts in an uproar about something. But tell us about the Canadian situation, what that would mean for Canada. And because, you know, as I sit here, I'm about 8 miles from Canada. And also how the United States and the Drug Enforcement Agency is reacting to it.
Well, as you said, the U.S. is not very happy about it. They've sent officials from the Drug Czar's office and the Drug Czar himself. They've gone up there to talk to, you know, law enforcement leaders and legislative, elected officials, and they've gone up there. And what they say their concern is that if Canada changes its marijuana laws, there's going to be an influx of marijuana coming into the U.S. from Canada. Of course, there already is. Although there's also a lot grown in this country, it wouldn't become legal to bring it into the country. That wouldn't change. So I think some of those fears are completely unfounded. You know, they like to say, well, we don't want to interfere with a sovereign nation. They can make their laws as they choose. However, I mean, there's always a but. You know, they say, well, we don't want marijuana coming in, and we might have to tighten the border. So they kind of threaten that. Previously, they've threatened trade sanctions against Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of crazy. What they want to do in Canada, they've been talking about this for a long time. It's got support at all levels of government. I mean, the Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, he supports it. And their equivalent of John Ashcroft, their Minister of Justice, Martin Cauchon, he introduced the legislation that's pending right now that has a good chance of passing. I mean, he himself introduced that. It's just such a foreign concept to me. It's like John Ashcroft in this country saying, hey, we need to change our marijuana laws. Let's, you know, decriminalize it. I wish that our country could be even close to that point. But what they want to do is basically for people caught with small amounts of marijuana, what they consider a personal amount, which is up to 15 grams, which is a half an ounce, there would be fines ranging in the couple of $100 range, and it would depend on how old you are. There's, I think it's a lower fine if you're under 18 or something along those lines. The problem with the legislation, because there was a lot of support for radical proposals. Originally, the Canadian Senate did a report, and they called for flat-out legalization. You could buy it and sell it if you were over 16. That was considered very radical. A couple months later, this was all last year, a couple months later, the Canadian equivalent of their House, they recommended decriminalization, so a little bit more moderate, and I think they had the age limit over 18 or 19, something along those lines. And now the legislation that's pending, it would be sort of a decriminalization, but bending to some pressure from, you've got to, think that it probably is the U.S., and some law enforcement officials in Canada are also opposed. So they've, in this legislation, they also want to double the fines for people who grow it. So it's kind of a little bit hypocritical, and there's some mixed reviews on this because you can't possess it unless you bought it from someone who grew it, you know, or someone along the way. So, it's kind of steps forward and steps back. But there's a lot of hope that this would pass, and, there's also momentum in the Canadian courts. There's decisions, I can't even keep up with them, because they're attacking marijuana laws at various levels. They have a whole other controversy with their medical marijuana laws. The government allowed medical marijuana within the past few years. It's been legalized. Yet they've had these problems getting it to patients because where are they supposed to get it? And the government grew some, and then they said it wasn't good enough to distribute, and then they ordered them to distribute it, and it's just now being released. I mean, it's just all of these little hurdles, but they're so far advanced from where we are. It's so refreshing to look at.
Yeah, and I guess there is concern in border, particularly in border cities like Detroit. I mean, people used to go, guys used to go a long time ago to Windsor, Ontario, because they had topless clubs, and then they had gambling casinos, and pretty soon, or if not already, gay men and women can get married there, and now people will be able to just cross an international border and probably pretty freely smoke marijuana. So that's a concern of officials here in the United States, probably of the Border Patrol, and probably the police in the Detroit area. But I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that they're moving in generally the right direction. And this war is not successful, is it? I mean, it has drained an enormous sum of money out of our economy. It has hurt people immensely by incarcerating them, putting legal records, giving them a legal record for the rest of their life. And still, I think you'll believe me if I say, Chrissy, excellent. I do not have any marijuana with me. I do not know right now how to buy any, but I suspect that I could probably get some within an hour. I would always, I know who around here I would ask, for instance, and I could probably be smoking a joint in an hour if I just started inquiring. So and so I've heard that marijuana is currently, more easily available. I forgot it was more easily available, of higher potency, and there was a third thing. I can't remember. It does cost a lot more money than it used to. But so it's been, on one hand, a catastrophic failure, but it's kind of like World War I. I mean, you just have these immense casualties.
Yeah, the way that I kind of think of it is, I don't know if I'll be able to explain this very well, but the cost that we're spending right now on marijuana prohibition is this immense cost, and people think that there's a great benefit from it, and there's not. And, if we got rid of this immense cost, and even if there was slightly increased marijuana use, which, this is a drug that's never killed anyone in 3,000 years of recorded use. It's impossible to overdose from it. I think you'd have to smoke something like a ton and a half in like 15 minutes.
I mean,
it's physically impossible.
I know people who have tried, but go ahead.
But, you actually can't overdose from it. So this drug that you cannot possibly die from, yet, you know, a couple hundred people die from aspirin every year. So even if there was some increased use, which there's actually evidence that when you relax marijuana laws, there's not increased use, or if there is, it's very temporary. Even if there was, though, I mean, worst case scenario, there's slightly increased use if you relax drug laws, the immense savings that you would get from not arresting people could be used on treatment or, you know, education campaigns like we have to discourage teens from smoking cigarettes, which have been pretty successful. They've cut rates on that a lot. And not by locking people up, by educating them and saying, you know, this isn't great for you and you probably shouldn't do it. So it's just the cost benefit. I mean, again, it's just people would examine it like they'd examine any other program. Marijuana prohibition would be out the window.
Well, I'm sort of prone, Chrissy Excellent, to using sometimes extreme language. So part of what I see the war on drugs is this immense racket. I mean, that transfers our personal wealth, what you and I have made, goes into the government in the form of tax money, and then it's spent on this useless, wasteful program. And yet thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people benefit from it because they are kind of cut in on the racket through different industries, through this prison industrial complex, and through a hundred other ways. I mean, if we all of a sudden we said, okay, it's over tomorrow, no more war on drugs, people can do to themselves what they choose rather than what the government decides they should do, there'd be a lot of people out of work and a lot of people saying, gee, I might have to get an honest job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I talk about this, sometimes people think I'm kind of this conspiracy theorist, but what you just said is absolutely true. I mean, there is this drug war industrial complex. You know, I don't think that the drug czar sits in his office and, you know, taps his fingers together and schemes up a way to keep his job. I mean, I think that people, you know, some people do think that drugs should be illegal for the good of society. But there are so many people whose jobs depend on it. You're absolutely right. And I think that, you know, they just see it as the way things are supposed to be. I don't think it's this active conspiracy, like, keep people down and put them in jail so the wardens have jobs. But
I agree. I
mean, it's absolutely right. There's so many, you know, you're always hearing about prison overcrowding. Let's build more prisons. Like, who are the people in those prisons? They're, you know, nonviolent drug offenders, a lot of them for marijuana. You've got judges to try the cases and got, you know, people that work in the prisons and DEA agents and, I mean, and on and on and on, people that, you know, administer drug tests. There's such an industry around it that I think that's part of the reason why it's just difficult to even think about changing the laws because there's such a foundation behind them.
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have a few minutes left. Chrissy Excellent is my guest. She's the Assistant Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project. I'm Peter Werby, and I guess probably where this issue intersects with the most sympathy is around the issue of medical marijuana. And where are we at now? We know that John Ashcroft, the great Puritan, has been raiding these hospices where people are smoking marijuana to relieve their pain in their final days and turning sick, dying people into criminals. But where is this at? I mean, there seems to be an attack on that.
Well, I think, unfortunately, for the time being, I think we can expect more raids, more prosecutions, more convictions, more people going to jail for this. Just today, the Senate confirmed a new head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, Karen Tandy. She's from Texas. She's been a prosecutor with the Justice Department for years. And she's the first female to head the DEA.
Hey, progress.
Well,
I'm only
not
kidding.
Really, since she basically is just continuing the raids that they've been, you know, doing for the past few years where they've really been stepped up. We were at the hearing today. Well, it wasn't the hearing, it was the vote. Her hearing was last week, but I use the term hearing loosely because there wasn't really a hearing. Nobody asked her any questions. Any senators who might possibly want to know about her views on medical marijuana, like Senator Feinstein from California, which has a law allowing medical marijuana. She wasn't at the hearing. There was another one scheduled at the same time she had to attend. So all questions for the nominee were submitted in writing. So, you know, that's not so difficult, not really a grilling in the Senate.
So your organization, for instance, couldn't put questions to her directly?
No, but we did work with, we worked with Senator Durbin of Illinois. He's a Democrat from Illinois, who before this, you know, hadn't really spoken out about this issue. And today he was the only senator who opposed her nomination. It's really amazing, actually. They were prepared to just confirm her without any discussion. You know, they had a whole full day of confirmations to approve and other business to get to. And when they called up Karen Tandy for nomination or for confirmation, the entire discussion, there was a discussion, and the whole discussion was about medical marijuana, which we were even surprised by. This is, the Senate never touches this issue. And for them to talk about this today was absolutely amazing. We hope this kind of turned the corner. And Senator Durbin discussed the questions he had submitted to the nominee in writing. He asked her if she plans to still make medical marijuana raids a priority of the Drug Enforcement Administration. And she basically said, yes, you know, our job is to enforce the law. So that's as good as saying, yeah, we're going to continue.
So if you're dying of cancer and marijuana relieves the pain or the nausea from chemotherapy,
you should go to jail.
Too bad. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Chrissy, we're out of time. Chrissy, excellent. Thanks for spending your this part of the day with us. The group is the Marijuana Policy Project. You wouldn't see almost from looking at our politicians and what's happening in government that there's been any forward motion on trying to bring about sensible drug policy reform. But I think there is almost a critical mass developing. A lot of at the state level, there's a lot of possibility to stop wasting our money on this war on the American people. If you want to go to the website for the Marijuana Policy Project, it's mpp.org, mpp.org. Chrissy, excellent. Thanks for spending the time with me.
Thanks for having me.
Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby and produced by OD. Stay tuned for more Riff Rock coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
No matter what's going on in your life, the Windfall 10-draw deal from the Michigan Lottery can make it easier. It works for Joe Fletcher. His mother-in-law is visiting for a month.
If my Janie had married the boy I picked, she'd be a doctor's wife by now. No offense, dear.
None taken, Mother Wilson.
Joe's happy because he's entered in the next 10 Windfall drawings, no matter what takes up his time.
Could you hold my yarn while I knit?
Why not? It was so much fun last night.
And Joe received two free easy picks for playing Windfall during the 10 draw deal, so nothing can ruin his mood.
You know, you should lose some weight.
A great idea, Mother Wilson!
It's the Windfall 10 draw deal. Just go to your Michigan Lottery retailer, pick your Windfall numbers, and extend your wager for the next 10 drawings. That's 5 weeks, and you'll get two free easy picks for the next drawing.
Oh, who wants to watch a silly hockey game?
Not me, not while there's a silk flower special on the decorating channel.
Feel good with the Windfall 10 draw deal, now through November 30th.
Wild Woody's in Roseville.
The wildest Woody's.
And 101 WRIF presents
the Miss Hawaiian Tropic Swimwear Competition.
Join the Riff and Carly.
As the most beautiful women in the Motor City compete for cash and prizes this Wednesday night.
As well as the chance to move on to the Hawaiian Tropic State Finals later this winter.
Hook up with killer Riff prizes courtesy of Wild Woody's and the Riff. Come out early for the wild Wednesday night debauchery you've come to expect.
Stay late and join the Metro's most beautiful people for the hottest Wednesday night dance party around.
Check out the wildest wait staff in town, and everyone can cash in on $1.50 bottles of beer all night long.
The search is on. The Miss Hawaiian Tropic Swimwear Competition this Wednesday night at Wild Woody's.
Wild Woody's.
Wild Woody's. Just minutes off I-94 on Gratiot between 13 and 14 Mile in downtown Roseville.
See Wild Woody's ad in this week's Real Detroit Weekly.
Wild Woody's.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can